Leave the girl. It's the man I want. Take him to my laboratory.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 21, Time and the Rani. I have, as ever, on the end of a Skype line, I would normally say at this point something like a four-eyed bat-like creature, but Martin doesn't wear glasses, so he's just a bat-like creature.
I am, yes, but I've come down from roosting in the ceiling to do this podcast.
Good, that'll spare the light fittings. So, yes, Time and the Rani today. Martin, as you inflicted this on us all, would you like to give us some context?
Yeah, okay, I will. Yes, this is from season 24, which of course is the first season of Sylvester McCoy, as this is his first story. It was broadcast from the 7th to the 28th of September 1987 on Monday evenings, opposite Coronation Street.
How could it not succeed?
It features the wonderful Bonnie Langford as Mel.
Are there two Bonnie Langfords?
Oh, yeah, sorry. It features the other Bonnie Langford as Mel. It's written by the wonderful Pip and Jane Baker.
Are there two other Pip and Jane Bakers?
The script editor is Andrew Cartmell, and producer John Nathan Turner. I'm a director on this one, Andrew Morgan. Obviously, it features the return of the Rani, who appeared 2 years previously opposite Colin Baker in Mark of the Rani. It features a new title sequence, which we'll talk about when we start the story itself. And of course, there's a lot of background to this, isn't there? Colin Baker was sacked as the Doctor following the Trial of a Time Lord season, basically because Michael Gray didn't like him, did he?
Hmm.
They were concerned about the ratings dropping as well, although it was around about 4 to 5 million the previous year, which in today's terms isn't terrible, is it? But in those days, I guess, it was not good.
Yeah.
Of course, there were big hopes for this new Doctor after Colin Baker. unfortunately, this is probably considered to be one of the worst Doctor Who stories ever made by a large number of people.
Yes.
Which we'll get to in a bit. Working title for this is Strange Matter. It's also the first score by Keith McCulloch. I'm sure you'll have much to say about that.
Ah, you know me so well.
I probably should point out at this time as well that following the Trial of the Time Lord season, John Nathan Turner had taken an extended winter break and was expecting to leave Doctor Who, but he was basically forced to return for another season, which actually turned out to be another 3 seasons. So after his extended break, he had to come back and put together a new series, and so there was a late rush to get scripts in, and he called on the ever-reliable Pip and Jane to provide this one.
Well, of course. Who would be the first people on your list if you wanted an excellent script?
I can think of who would be at the bottom of the list. Anyway, moving on.
The script editor is Andrew Cartmell, but it's worth pointing out at this stage he was brought in at quite a late stage in this, and he wanted to move the show into what he described as funkier new direction. Time and the Rani does not benefit from this funkier direction, but apparently Paradise Towers does, which is the next story, so I'll leave it up to the viewer to decide whether the new funky direction was better or worse. But Andrew Cartmell considered Time and Rani to be a rather old-fashioned style of story for what he wanted to to do with the show. And consequently, he was butting heads with Pip and Jay Baker quite regularly about the script. And if you throw Andrew Morgan, the director, into the mix, it turned out to be a story that no one was actually happy with. Andrew Cartmell, Andrew Morgan, Pip and Jane Baker. I don't know about J&T, whether he liked it, but certainly those three people or sets of people weren't happy with the end result. And neither, for the most part, was the viewer.
The viewer singular.
That was about right, I think. Yeah, we should say at this point, although both of us went into this not expecting much, we both have tried to think about the positive side of stuff as well, rather than just slagging the whole thing off. But you can only work with what you're given, so there'd probably be a fair amount of slagging off.
Okay, so we start with a pre-title sequence, don't we? The third of only four pre-title sequences in Classic Who. The two that preceded this were obviously the Five Doctors with a clip of Hartnell from Dalek Invasion of Earth, and Castrovalva, which has the kind of reprise from the end of Legopolis before the titles. And the only one I can think of afterwards is Remembrance of the Daleks, which has the Dalek mothership approaching Earth, doesn't it?
Yes.
So, what's in this pre-title sequence?
It's a fairly rubbish computer game involving the TARDIS being shot at.
It is. We've got the TARDIS in space being hit by various laser beams. It's very computer generated, isn't it?
Yes.
Inside the TARDIS, things don't get much better. lying on the floor, unconscious, are Mel, played by Bodie Langford, of course, and what would appear to be the Sixth Doctor, lying face down. We then cut to a quarry somewhere, which has got kind of pink sky, hasn't it? And there's a strange-looking alien watching as the TARDIS gets drawn along this kind of rainbow effect, and it lands in the quarry, doesn't it? Then the Rani enters the TARDIS. Not sure how she gets in through a locked door, but...
Yes, with a big gun.
With a very big gun, yes. And she says, "Leave the girl, it's the man I want." And orders someone to take the Doctor to her lab. And then these pair of hairy legs appear. And you see, shot from behind, this creature come in, move over and turn the Doctor over to reveal his face, which is Sylvester McCoy in a blonde wig with a swirly effect on his face.
Yes. It is, without doubt, the worst regeneration ever, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, clearly. You know, the effect disappears, as does the wig, and the real McCoy's face is revealed.
The real McCoy, I like it. Very clever. Yes, God bless him. Colin Baker said he'd come back to do a regeneration scene if he could have another season, which he regenerated at the end. They declined, so he declined to take part in this regeneration sequence. That said, I'm sure it could have been done better than this, even without his involvement. It's so clearly Sylvester McCoy before he regenerates into Sylvester McCoy that it renders the whole thing pointless.
Yeah, I mean, they should have just got a Colin Baker lookalike or something, or somebody just with the same kind of shaped head, really, and just put a different effect so that you completely obscure the features.
Have the effect taking place before he's turned over, or turn him over after the effect's taking place, or something. But just don't do what they actually did.
No.
It was appalling. The other thing to say about this regeneration is that the reason for it is never really explained. Sure, the TARDIS is buffeted by what appear to be kind of laser bolts in the sky, which apparently is the Rani using a weapon to bring down the TARDIS. But given that you've got a not particularly robust human in Mel, who does come out of this unscathed, you've got a considerably more robust Time Lord who doesn't.
Well, you have to kind of assume that he like whacks his head on the console or something, really, don't you? If you want to find a reason. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty lame, whatever the reason is, really, isn't it?
I'm sure with a bit of thought, a better way of doing this without Colin Baker's involvement it could have been sorted out. I don't know if they were short on time or short on ideas, but as it stands, it's about as bad as it could have been.
I quite agree. It's dreadful. Anyway, we'll move on from that, because we could probably talk about that all podcast. But
well, we have to let it go.
Leave it, Jim, leave it. We then get the wonderful new title sequence. Oh, my God.
I didn't get a wonderful new title sequence on my copy.
So the new title sequence, designed by Oliver Elms and realised by Gareth Edwards. I don't think it's as bad as you think it is, to be honest.
Yeah, we have mentioned this in previous Sylvester McCoy stories that we've covered on this podcast. I think it's the worst one. I don't think it's absolutely awful.
No.
But it's not as good as any of the others.
I agree. I mean, I don't think it's awful by any means. I think it's reasonably good, to be honest. But it is, I would agree, the worst of the title sequences that there are. What I hate about it is McCoy's wink.
The wink was, as it turns out in researching this story, all the worst ideas of this are John Nathan Turner's. His idea was to have Sylvester McCoy winking in the title sequence.
What was that? Winking, did you say?
Winking in the title sequence, yeah. It's a family show.
that would have made it very different, wouldn't it?
It would have done, yes. It probably would have got taken off the air a lot quicker. At the beginning of part four, the unimproved, in inverted commas, version, the version before J&T got hold of it, is used, in which Sylvester McCoy doesn't wink. So make the most of that one if you come and watch episode four of this one. But you have to sit through three episodes before that, unfortunately. And I should point out also that this is the worst Doctor Who logo as well.
But yeah, you know, we don't want to dwell on these negatives.
And the worst Doctor Who theme tune, Kev McCulloch.
Yes, I'd agree with that.
But I do have a positive thing to say. We then have a shot of the Rani's citadel on the planet Lycurtia, which looks good.
It does.
Yeah, it's a model. It's kind of melded with the live action of the sort of quarry and a quite impressive sort of entrance below it. And it looks very good.
Yeah, I think it does as well. Well, as we find out, some of the effects in this story are very good, I think. Mm.
So we see out on this quite impressive sort of quarry landscape. And I do like the pink sky that's been sort of paintboxed in, hasn't it? There's another sort of, these aliens are kind of sort of slightly leonine, aren't they? And slightly reptilian, because they've got scales in their faces.
Yeah.
And they've got sort of manes. They're very 1980s stock alien, aren't they? very day-glow colours, which we come to expect in this era of Doctor Who, really. This is a young female Lycurtian, from the planet Lycurtia, called Sarn, played by Karen Clegg. I'm going to have to get negative again, because she is crap.
Do you know what? When I first heard her speak, I thought it was the actress that played Tazenbecker in Revelation of the Daleks.
But I grew to like Tazenbecker, but yeah. I didn't grow to like Sarn at any point.
Well, he doesn't last long, does she? Thankfully.
No, she's awful. I mean, she's apparently untrained as she would appear to be. But yeah, mercifully, she's not in it to speak of. But anyway, she's putting what appears to be Albert Einstein into a strange sort of cabinet. She seals his cabinet and, upon the Rani's instruction, labels it Einstein. There's another older one of these Lycurtian aliens with her. This is Baus, played by Donald Pickering, who recently for us in the Crinoid podcast we saw in Keys and Marinus. He was also in The Faceless Ones. As I say, these are Lycurtians from the planet Lycurtia, which is where all this takes place.
It made me laugh, actually. The Rani has to tell Sarn the name of this genius. She said it's Einstein. And then Sarn kind of types it in and gets the spelling right first time.
She's cleverer than she would appear to be.
Because it's not an obvious kind of spelling, is it? If you've, especially if you've never heard the name before.
No, and you're using a different alphabet to the one you used. Yeah, that's a good point. Mm. Yeah, she's not given it. I mean, quite tedious if the Rani had to spell it out to her.
But yeah, it would, but, you know, it just made me laugh.
Why doesn't the Rani just type it? You know, it would make more sense, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah.
It becomes quite clear that these Lycurtians are being oppressed by the Rani, and she's using them to her own despicable ends. Baus is quite a sort of meek character, isn't he? And he weakly argues with the Rani to let Sarn go. She has him as hostage. She doesn't need Sarn as well, but the Rani's not interested. And the Rani then goes into some plot exposition that tells us that all her specimens in these cabinets are geniuses. Genii, is that the plural?
Probably. I'll be saying geniuses, but you can say genii if you wish.
No, I think I'll go geniuses. As you know, I'm utterly unpretentious.
Sorry, I'll edit out me laughing for half an hour.
Yes, I wish you would. Anyway, Narani leaves and says that she now has the means to repair her laboratory equipment.
Mm-hmm. In the lab, McCoy is lying on a table wearing Colin Baker's costume still. Narani comes in and checks on him, places a hand over each of his hearts, and then she goes off and operates a panel which opens a door in another part of the laboratory. She starts to climb the steps to go through this door when she hears the doctor moaning. He says, "Oh no, Mel." And she quickly closes the door again and goes over to him, at which point he jumps up and says that he's had a good nap, and he starts rattling off a list of things that he needs to do, doesn't he? But he has some questions, and he says, "Where am I? Who am I? And who are you?" And he turns around pointing at the Rani. And he recognises her straight away, doesn't he? As she moves towards him, he turns and falls down a step. This is just dreadful.
Well, the Rani's next words are, "This is idiotic." One is tempted to say, "No, something, Sherlock," at this point. It is certainly idiotic.
But it gets worse. Yes, the Doctor says that she has contempt for all Time Lords. And then he says, "And what do you want with me? And where's Mel?" Which is, it's just totally, it doesn't flow at all. It's just weird and rubbish.
Well, it's poorly scripted and it's poorly acted, certainly on McCoy's behalf.
It's cringeworthy, to be honest. It's a shame, really, because he does improve, as we'll find out, but...
He definitely does, but, yeah, this is just... When you think it's a very important moment, isn't it, the first few moments, and they're not necessarily symptomatic of what that incarnation is going to be like, because, you know, the first episode or so of a post-regenerative story, you know, the Doctor's always in a bit of a mess, isn't he?
Mm.
But, you know, for anyone who's hoping things will have improved from, you know, the trial of a Time Lord, well, I mean, I was one of these people, and I was watching it and thinking, when I thought it couldn't get any worse, it had.
Yeah, totally agree. Dreadful scene, really. But anyway, the Doctor operates a kind of monitor screen that's on his desk he was lying on. He's trying to find out what the Rani is up to, but she basically tells him that they're on Lucertia. But he finds that there's an asteroid composed of strange matter that's in orbit around the planet. And he says, "What monstrous experiment are you dabbling in now?"
Part of the naturalistic dialogue you get throughout the story.
Yeah. Can't really blame McCoy. He hasn't got anything to work with, has he?
No, not at all, no.
I won't have to blame him a bit, because it's still really badly done. But yeah, it's pretty poor.
We said we were going to try and find the positive. There's an interesting bit here, I think, where you kind of understand a little bit where the Rani is coming from, although you can't, you know, agree with it unless you have extremely far-right politics. But she believes that she should be able to carry out her experiments regardless of the consequences on inferior species. When the Doctor sort of shows disdain for this point of view, she says, "Are you prepared to abandon walking in case you squash an insect underfoot?"
Mm.
As she was originally written in Time of the Rani, she's sort of slightly cold and whatever the opposite of compassion is. She just literally doesn't care. She's not evil. She just doesn't care about these things, if you see what I mean.
Well, she sees, like you say, she sees it as inferior, therefore fair game, basically.
Yeah. At this point, the Doctor falls over again, and to make a bad scene even worse, Sarn turns up, tries to help him with some awful acting.
Mm.
And the Rani sort of chases her off, really, doesn't she? Barks at her, and she runs off. And then McCoy jumps to his feet and says he's going to smash some of the Rani's equipment with his umbrella. As he's about to smash his equipment, which is more like to smash his umbrella, I would have thought, if he starts whacking
it. I don't know, it's a BBC set.
True. Yeah, he'd have to pull his punches quite dramatically in order not to smash it to pieces. The Rani calls in one of the aliens that picked the Doctor out of the TARDIS in the first place. They are, as we later find out, tetraps. And this one is a chief tetrap called Urak. And this is another quite good bit, I thought. They have an eye on each of the four sides of their head, basically. And that makes, when they move to this subjective sort of point of view, camera view, it makes it quite interesting because you can see all these images sort of working together.
Yeah, and they kind of zone in on him, don't they?
Yes. It fires a weapon which sends a sort of glittery net over the Doctor's gurning head. And he then at this point quite mercifully faints.
Should point out here, we don't actually get to see Urek's head at this point, do we? We're still only seeing his hairy legs.
Well, they're so brilliant that it's the suspense in waiting for them to be revealed just really heightens the tension.
Oh, I take it you don't like them then.
More of that later.
More of that later. We switch to outside in the quarry again, and another like Lycurtian, the one we saw right at the very start. This one's called Icona. He's found the TARDIS, and he manages to get inside, where he finds the unconscious Belle. He picks her up, throws her over his shoulder. We then see Sarn running from out of the Rani's citadel into this quarry. And then we're back in the laboratory again, aren't we? Where the doctor has got this wire net over him, and he's unconscious. The Rani operates a kind of a wrist device, and Urek's voice comes over it telling her that Sarn has escaped. She switches on the scanner, which shows Sarn running through this quarry. They try and make them appear alien, don't they? By when they're running, they hold their arms out behind them, which kind of half-hearted attempt to show that they're an alien race, but it just looks daft, if you ask me.
It looks very daft. Apparently there are some lizards that run like that, and Akersha is, I think, Greek or something for lizard.
Brilliant.
Yeah. It still looks stupid.
I didn't know there were so many layers in this plot. It's like an onion, isn't it?
It is. It's like an onion that's gone off.
And it's just really stinking.
Yep. So Sarn is running like a lizard stroke idiot.
Was that a command? I haven't got one to hand.
If any idiots...
Myself doesn't count.
No, don't stroke yourself while we're doing a podcast. But if any idiots would like to go around to Martin's house, he'll gladly stroke you. But apparently, on this subject, really, the script at this point, we move to Icona carrying Mel over his shoulder in the quarry. The script at this point says, Icona is still humping Mel.
I'm sorry, but that just would never happen.
No, I really had no inclination to hump Mel in my life, and I was surprised if he had as well. But anyway, he's actually just carrying her over his shoulder. She wriggles a bit, he falls over, and she escapes. It's all very believable. And then she almost bumps into Sarn running towards her from the other direction, who then decides to change direction and runs straight into a tripwire, which sets off perhaps one of the only good things about time in the Rani, which is these bubble traps.
Mm.
So, I mean, you could say that Mel's character did one good thing, and that was to get rid of Sarn. But anyway, she gets caught in this sort of bubble. This bubble starts spinning, and then it takes off, and it flies off into the air, and it sort of bounces off one of these crags in the quarry, and then explodes when it hits another one. And that's the end of Sarn.
It is indeed. Mel goes over to Icona, who's looking at Sarn's skeleton, which is all that's left of her. She puts her hand out to his arm, and he kind of knocks it away, and he kneels down and has a bit of a cry.
Mm. His skeleton's quite good, isn't it? It's
yeah.
Got a sort of vestigial tail, isn't it, and a sort of bony crest on the skull.
Yeah, they've done a good job of that. And like you say, I think the bubble effect is really good. In fact,
yeah,
it's probably one of the best effects seen in Doctor Who up to this point, isn't it?
I remember being quite amazed at the time.
I was amazed that they wasted those effects on this dire story. The Rani is watching all this on the scanner, isn't she, from her laboratory, and she orders Urek to go and reset the trap. Baeus asks her what's happened. She says it needn't concern him. Of course, it does concern him when he finds out a bit later. And she asks him to lift the doctor's sleeve, because she wants to give him a shot of something that's going to cause amnesia. And then we're back with Mel and Icona, who are arguing. He thinks she's working for the Rani. Says that he needs her as a hostage, because he needs to exchange her for somebody. He takes a kind of cord from his robe, doesn't he, and grabs her. So he's obviously going to try and tie her up. And then back in the lab, the doctor awakes, and he's on the floor, and he sees somebody from behind who looks a bit like Mel. She's wearing the same clothes as Mel. You know, she's got red hair, and he kind of says, "Who are you?" And it turns around. It's the Rani, clearly dressed, pretending to be the doctor's assistant.
Yeah, just when he thought it couldn't get any worse, this whole section of the Rani masquerading as Mel, well, it's beyond pantomime, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I know what you mean. I think she actually does quite a good job of it, though. She's almost more like a Mel than Mel is, really.
That's weird, to be honest.
Well, I like her impersonation, if you know what I mean. I don't like, you know, it's just, it's all nonsense, but...
Well, I think Kate O'Mara did the best that she could, but to see an actress the wrong side of 40 trying to be someone in, I guess she's in her 20s, is she Bonnie Langford at this point?
Mm.
You'd have to be an imbecile not to tell any difference between them.
Or a newly regenerated doctor. Yeah,
yeah, with an amnesia drug. Yeah, fair enough, but... Actually, just as I said, I thought it couldn't get any worse. It does get worse because the doctor sort of wakes up groggy and practically falls over. And then he starts a tiresome trait, which I think only appears for this story, doesn't it? And it turns out it's John Nathan Turner's idea. He takes a well-known phrase or aphorism and it just mangles it, really. He nearly falls over and says, a bull in a barber's shop. To their credit, and I don't say this often, Pip and Jane Baker weren't keen on this, but obviously they had to incorporate it, so they stick this in the script far too many times, really, this kind of stuff, but they sounds like they enjoyed it about as much as the audience did.
Well, yeah, I would agree with you. It's really, really annoying.
Well, it's like a pathetic way of adding a characterization to a character, isn't it? Just take a stupid, you know, habit or trait or whatever and just make them do it all the time rather than making them sort of more rounded.
Well, like unstable, unstable,
unstable. Yep, exactly like that. Yes, one of the many things that, that grates. As the doctor falls over, sort of grabs hold of this navigational guidance system distorter that was lying on the desk, which is the thing we saw the Rani holding earlier when she walked to the TARDIS. And he recognises it and he realises it forces spaceships to land. So that's why the TARDIS was forced to land on Lucertia.
The Rani then tries to convince the Doctor that it's actually his laboratory rather than hers. He passes this mirror and he kind of looks in into this mirror and goes, who's that? And she says it's you. And he's, me? That again is just awful. I hated that bit. And he's basically not too keen on his new persona. It's a bit of a throwback to John Pertwee when he's given a mirror, isn't he? And he has a look at his face and he doesn't like it.
Yes, it's standard stuff, isn't it, for post-regeneration, isn't it?
Yeah.
One thing I did like, actually, is one of the first moments I started warming to the Seventh Doctor, and that was when he storms up and says, I want all mirrors removed from the TARDIS henceforth.
Yeah, I mean, from about here onwards, he actually gets better. It's really that opening scene and this little bit, which I didn't like either. Anyway, the Rani says that he has been conducting an experiment which went wrong and exploded, knocking them both out. And when they came round, the Doctor looked like this, so he had a new face. That's quite a good line from the Rani here, saying, you mean this is what you're going to be like permanently?
Yes.
I thought that was really good, actually.
Yeah, she delivers it in that squeaky voice that she melts. But as the Doctor mentions the TARDIS when he's talking about getting the mirrors removed, that seems to have some effect on him, doesn't it? He remembers Mel again, but when he looks at the Rani version of Mel, he thinks something's out of sync. He puts it down to post-regenerative amnesia, which of course has been helped along by the injection from the Rani. The Rani, as she does quite a lot in this episode or at this stage in the story, basically just changes the subject, doesn't she, when anything gets difficult. She persuades him that he was going to repair some of the equipment. She reminds him that he's a genius, and he says, yeah, I definitely remember that, which is quite a nice line. She says thermodynamics was his specialist subject at university. Again, this jogs his memory. He looks at the Rani stroke Mel and says that she reminds him of someone he knew at university, and of course we know that the Rani went to the university with the Doctor. But again, she sort of drags him over to this damaged equipment, which seems to contain a Perspex pyramid full of sweet wrappers.
Yeah, this set isn't particularly good. But moving swiftly on, Icona is dragging Mel along through the quarry outside. He's tied a rope to her wrists and he's dragging her along. She tries to engage with him, tells him her name, and he tells her that the Doctor wasn't in the box with her where he found her. and they continue to argue.
At this point, apparently the noise of the actors walking on the rocks drowned out all of the dialogue, which happens quite a lot in this story. Dialogue has been dubbed on afterwards. Mm. It's not quite so noticeable here, but it is quite noticeable in other places.
Yeah, it's true. Anyway, as they continue to argue, Icona's about to step on the tripwire and Mel pulls him back just in time. He sets it off, but he, you know, it doesn't encase him. The bubble appears and it rises empty and it explodes on the cliff face harmlessly. And this basically convinces him that, you know, she's fine. So he unties her, saying that the Tetraps will be along soon to investigate. He says that he didn't trust her because she's not a Lycurtian, so she doesn't belong on this planet. But as they walk off, you see that they're being watched from above by the hairy arms of a Tetrap holding a gun.
Yeah, I don't suppose the arms are watching them, but...
Well, they've got eyes everywhere. Maybe they've got them in their arms.
Yeah, there's quite a nice line, I think, here from Icona. Is that it turns out the Tetraps are sort of vaguely humanoid, but not like Mel, but almost as hideous.
Yeah.
He doesn't like very much, but... So the last thing we see in this scene is this Tetrap aiming a gun at Icona and Mel. And it's quite a nice cut here, isn't it? Because it looks like he's about to fire this gun, and the next thing we see is a shower of sparks, but it's the doctor messing up some work on the equipment in Barani's laboratory. So it's quite a nice little segue between the two scenes. Mm. And there is actually a quite amusing bit here, I think, where the doctor's leaning over this equipment, and he basically stops and expects the Rani stroke Mel to do something. And after a bit of confusion, it turns out she wants him to mop his brow. And I think McCoy really sells this one really well.
Mm-hmm. It was a great face from Kate Mara's, wasn't it?
Yeah, they both do really well, don't they, in this scene? And so she reluctantly does and looks sort of disgusted with herself after. Unfortunately, after a good start to this scene, the doctor finds what appear to be two of those kind of salad servers, kind of long plastic spoons and sporks, you call them, don't you? Mm. So it's half spoon, half fork. And he decides to play the spoons with them.
Just when he thought it couldn't go to any lower depths.
Yes, as we keep saying in this, and it still continues to do so.
Yeah. Why is there a rack of sporks in this laboratory, for one thing?
Well, maybe the Rani stops for salad breaks regularly.
It's another J&T, isn't it?
It is, yeah, because that's one of the things that Sylvester McCoy specialises in. He thought, oh, yeah, we'll put that in the show. We should point out other things he used to specialise in was banging nails up his nose and sticking ferrets down his trousers. Thankfully, J&T stopped short of forcing those two things into the show.
Have you not seen the missing scenes?
The director's cut. The producer's cut, I suppose. Nasty. But apparently Pip and Jane Baker weren't keen on this either, so my respect grows slightly. And then for some reason, one of these like mangled aphorisms gets dragged in again. The doctor just shoehorns a bad workman always blames his fools into the conversation, much to everyone's mystification. Plot-wise, the doctor is coming to a conclusion that this sort of laboratory and the whole setup really hasn't got anything to do with him. So the Rani realises he's just a try and persuade him otherwise.
Yeah, he says that he knows what the machine will do, but he doesn't know what it's for. Meanwhile, Icona and Mel outside, he's telling her about his people, that they have been completely subdued by the Rani, and they'll only listen to Baus, but Baus is a hostage. He's the hostage that he wanted to exchange Mel for. They then hear something up on the rocks, and you see some loose debris coming down, don't you? And they start running. Icona with his arms behind him again, and they seek refuge in a kind of concrete pipe which has some nice tinsel around it at its midpoint. So.
Well, maybe a concrete duct is too sort of Earth-like, isn't it? But the addition of tinsel makes it entirely alien.
It's dreadful, though.
Either that, or it's a concrete duct during the Christmas period. Maybe it's remnants from the last BBC party.
Probably is.
Yeah. We get back to the lab. The doctor wants to know, and this is just perhaps goes on far too long, I think. He wants to know what's behind these locked doors at the top of the steps, and he continues to want to know this for about three episodes. the audience is less interested, I think. But anyway, Rani says she doesn't know, as the doctor has never let her inside. She says that he told her the air wasn't sterile enough for humans. But at this point, the doctor doesn't really know what's going on. He can't remember anything, and he just downs tools, basically, until his memory returns. And then we see the Rani creep over to her desk and get a small phial out of it. I mean, phial as in a small bottle, not some A4 in some bulldog clips or whatever.
Or a nail file.
Or a nail file, come to that.
Baez, meanwhile, is kind of outside in a corridor nearby, and he opens this hatchway, which goes down into kind of a dark cellar-type place. We hear some deep animal breathing. He kind of pulls his chain, which releases some steaming goo into a trough, and then he beats a hasty retreat as something approaches. It's all quite dark, so we can't really see what's going on. But quite an eerie little scene, I thought.
Mm.
Back upstairs, the Rani's poured this blue liquid into a glass of water, which he tries to get the doctor to drink, but he doesn't want it. And he says he's feeling down. He kind of contemplates whether this is his new persona, sulky and bad-tempered. He comes out with regeneration as a lottery, and I've drawn the short plank. Which I thought was actually one of the few times that these mangled proverbs, or whatever they are, worked.
Yeah, I quite like that one as well. This is something that Sylvester McCoy is keen to do, isn't it? To make his doctor more melancholy.
Mm.
He was aware of the weight of years that must be on the doctor by now, and the amount of deaths he's seen and all during his long life and all the rest of it. And he's very good at these scenes, I think. And they become quite a sort of trademark, don't they, for him as his portrayal continues.
Yeah, true.
But he decides that he needs a radiation wave meter in order to make anything of what's going on in the laboratory. The Rani, dressed as Mel, decides that the TARDIS is somewhere that could get this from. He seems to be quite excited that she might know where the TARDIS is. They both kind of head off to the TARDIS, but the Rani kind of hangs back and uses a wrist communicator to talk to Urak to tell him to get the girl out of the TARDIS. Urak tells her that the girl's not in the TARDIS, and she sort of angrily tells him to go and find her.
Mm. We then see Mel and Icona, who are still in this pipe, concrete pipe. She wants to find the doctor, but Icona's still worried that it's not safe. The doctor and the Rani are now outside in the quarry, and they pass Sarn's skeleton. The doctor goes over to inspect it. The Rani tells him that it's a Lycurtian, and she kind of comments on their race, saying that they're lethargic and they've failed to fulfill their full potential, which the doctor thinks is a harsh judgment, but she says that it's his judgment. She's just repeating what he's said. And then he says, the more I know me, the less I like me. And they continue on.
Yeah, he does wave at the skeleton, doesn't he, in a sort of comedic fashion, which doesn't really work with the rest of the scene, is it? Because he seems to be quite sad that this alien, whatever it is, has died. But then he sort of grins and waves it as he walks on. So the characterization is a bit patchy at this stage.
Yeah.
Then we go to the traditional what costume is the new doctor going to wear sequence.
Mm-hmm.
We get in every story after the doctor's just regenerated. I won't say all the lines that he says after each one because they're all annoying, but he starts off as Napoleon, then a soldier with a sort of busby on his head, then he emerges with a teacher's gown and mortarboard, and then he starts using previous doctor's outfits, doesn't he? And he comes out with Tom Baker's sort of burgundy outfit from his last season, then a stupendously extra frilly version of Pertwee's outfit. then Davison's cricket outfit. Of course, they all look daft on Sylvester McCoy because all those actors were taller than him. I will just point out what he says after the Davison's one. He says, "How's that with that bowler maiden over?" And you hear glass breaking in the distance for comedic effect.
Oh, was it for comedic effect?
Yeah, well, or annoying effect, as it turns out. I should point out also that the TARDIS room that they're in is very half-assed, isn't it? They just basically put some black drapes around a standard BBC studio, and that's it. We're supposed to believe it's a TARDIS. Anyway, the significant moment from this scene is that he comes out in Troughton's fur coat. He opens it to reveal the Seventh Doctor regular outfit. John Nathan Turner's brief here was to make his outfit less striking than previous ones, which makes a change for Jonathan Turner, is the king of the Dayglow outfit. And it is, really. I mean, apparently it's not dissimilar to what Sylvester McCoy is wearing when he went for the auditions.
Yeah, it's fine, his costume. It's obviously a vast improvement on Colin Baker's.
Good enough, definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, the Rani says that he's very elegant and is keen to get back to the lab. But he looks at her intently, doesn't he? And her face kind of melds with that of Mel, doesn't it? The camera shows Mel's face over the top of the Rani's.
It's interesting, isn't it? If Bonnie Langford had Kate O'Mara's bone structure, she'd be quite attractive. Because that's what you see, don't you? You just see her features superimposed over the Rani's face. And she's quite fit, to be honest.
Moving on.
I quite fancy the Mel Rani hybrid.
You're weird. Anyway, the doctor's kind of staring intently at this, and the Rani slaps him, doesn't she?
Yeah.
She says she's sorry that he seems to be losing control. And he starts to remember the Rani, doesn't he? Since it's kind of on the tip of his tongue, but she distracts him yet again by asking about this radiation wave meter and suggests that it will be in the tool room.
That's where you live, isn't it, Martin? The tool room?
No. And then we get another mixed proverb, don't we? Absence makes the nose grow longer. And she says, well, everybody else is thinking that's watching this. Cretin.
Yes, absolutely. We then turn to Mel running through the quarry with the Icona, for some reason, miles behind her.
Mm.
It's probably because he has to do that stupid run. We then see a stupid-looking head and massive, unrealistic claw appear above a rock. They're still trying to keep the tetrap true appearance, you know, hidden from the viewer. Back in the TARDIS, the Doctor overhears Urak using the name Rani over her communicator. Rani's in the main console room. He rushes in, having recognised Rani as the evil name that he was trying to remember just before he got slapped. And the Rani quickly says, oh, is that her? Pointing to Mel on the TARDIS scanner. The Doctor decides, well, if Mel's in the room with him, then that must be the Rani. So he agrees, and the Rani says, well, she must be destroyed then. And the Doctor sort of pauses and says, well, no, let's not be hasty.
Outside, Mel turns to see Urak up on the clifftop, and she starts running and runs straight into one of these tripwires.
Hooray!
And, of course, the bubble appears, encasing her, and she starts screaming.
Yes.
And then Episode 2, she screams. Episode 3, she screams. Episode 4, she screams, and the Doctor solves the Rani's thing, and that's it.
That's it. Well, let's
So tune in next time.
Let's write the story.
Yeah, the bubble bounces off the one of the crags, doesn't it? And then you get a close-up of Mel kind of spinning around and screaming incessantly. And the episode ends.
Yeah, well, if this is a cliffhanger, then the jeopardy must be that Mel might survive, mustn't it?
Yeah, and unfortunately, it comes true.
Yes. So, into part two, a quick word on part one, because this is quite a key episode in Doctor Who's history. It must be one of the least well-received of all time. Even the Doctor Who Appreciation Society turned against it. Andrew Beach is a member of that. He turns up in the Daily Mail. He accuses the production team of murdering the show in that first episode. We then had points of view, and someone says it was the most appalling, mindless dribble which would insult the intelligence of a five-year-old. It's mixed reviews, because someone actually said that they thought McCoy showed great talent in his portrayal of the Doctor. So it wasn't all bad, but probably 95% of it was.
Well, yeah, it's pretty poor, isn't it?
It's the worst episode of this.
Yeah, by a long way, I think.
Yeah, and there aren't many single episodes that are worse than this one.
No, I can't think of many.
Twin Dilemma, mainly, probably.
Yeah, any of the four episodes of the Twin Dilemma.
Yeah, probably, yeah. One of four. But, I mean, this is certainly, I don't think I was watching this with anybody. If I'd been watching this with anybody, I'd have been desperately embarrassed.
Yeah, it is awful, and thankfully it does improve.
But you can't do anything else than improve, can you?
Well, we kept saying throughout it that it couldn't get any worse, and then it did. At least they get all the rubbish out of the way, or most of it, in the first episode.
That's true, yeah, they do.
Anyway, let's get into part two. Unfortunately, the bubble lands on water, doesn't it?
Oh.
Foiled again. So there's a kind of lake in this quarry, isn't it? We keep calling it a quarry, it's the planet.
the planet Lacertia. Whenever we say quarry, we mean the planet Lacertia. It happens to be in a selection of quarries near Frome in Somerset, which is just down the road from me.
Mm.
I must go and visit.
You should do, you should go and reminisce.
Yes.
Anyway, Mel continues to scream incessantly despite now being relatively safe on the water. Icona comes over to try and help her out. But there's a kind of a metal tube protruding from the bubble, isn't there? He kind of puts his hand out to touch it. And then we get another of these cuts where it cuts back to the doctor in the lab and there's another explosion of sparks. And the doctor's working on this machine again in the Rhino's lab. You know, the second time that's been used. I think it's quite clever, I think.
Mm. I should point out at this point, Icona tells Mel off for squawking, doesn't it? just before that moment, which again is what the audience would think.
Yeah, the doctor gets up, coughing and waving away the plume of smoke that accompanies this explosion of sparks. And he's feeling sorry for the Rani, that she was caught in her own trap. The Rani, Mel, tries to get him back to work, but he's still worried about what's behind this locked door. And he says that the Rani's got a brilliant but sterile mind. She then compliments him on his superior diagnostic talents. She says it's a pity they can't be concentrated on the machine, and she pushes him, and he whacks his head on it, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah, this is one of several whackings of heads that the doctor gets, isn't he, during this story. Thankfully, this one doesn't make him regenerate. But anyway, back to Icona and Mel. Icona removes the explosive device attached to this bubble, and the bubble disappears. So Mel sort of jumps into his arms, safe. And he hurls his explosive device into the lake, and there's quite an impressive explosion. Isn't it?
Mm.
They're observed by a sort of wobbly tetrap, aren't they? They do the classic Doctor Who monster thing of just standing, not still, but just sort of wobbling around where they are. The Doctor realises that the Rani and Mel are dressed the same, finally, but comes to the conclusion that it was the Rani that he saw in the bubble trap, and she was dressed as Mel. Disguise is one of her specialities, as we saw in Mark of the Rani. And so, you know, the Rani is still safe in her disguise as Mel, as the Doctor still hasn't twigged it the other way around.
We then get another scene of Baus going to feed the tetraps, and then we're back with Mel and Icona, who are creeping around the quarry. Icona goes and fetches a gun from up on the kind of cliff face, and he leaves Mel waiting down below. And then one of the tetraps attacks and jumps down and stands in front of her for a bit.
For a bit of what?
Well, it's not a bit of that, is it? It's got any sense. But this is the first time we see its head in all its glory. And, of course, as you said, it's got eyes on all the sides. It looks a bit bat-like, doesn't it? I think the mask isn't too bad.
Oh, come on.
It's a bit rubbery, but...
It's one of those things that it couldn't be anything other than a costume. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it definitely, yeah. Yeah. It wasn't worth the wait, but...
It's a classic trope of Doctor Who to conceal the complete sort of revelation of a monster until later on, and you get tantalising glimpses to make the effect of them finally appearing that much more spectacular. I kind of feeling kind of the opposite approach here, just to try and hide it for as long as possible, because they're embarrassed about it.
Yeah, I don't think they're that bad. Although, having done Keys of Marinus recently, you look back at that from the very first season of Doctor Who, and it's better.
Yep.
I think they try to do too much with it, really, to be too clever with it, but it does just look too much like a mask.
Mm.
Suit.
With a little pot belly.
But yeah, not overly convinced, but I'm not as down on it as you are by the sound of it.
Well done for your eternal optimism and positive thinking.
Clutching at straws again. Anyway, predictably, Mel stands and screams, and once again, Icona comes to the rescue, and with his newly acquired gun, he shoots at this tetrap, which showers sparks over it, doesn't it? Is it one of these glitter guns again with a net?
No.
It's a different one, isn't it?
It's a different one to what the tetraps use. Kind of showers it with sort of scraps of tin foil, doesn't it?
Mm.
Apparently the idea behind this was that because these are sort of bat-like, and they use kind of sonar like Earth bats do, if you're trying to confuse a radar, you can do it with, like, sending scraps of tinfoil up into the air, and I think that was the idea behind this. Unfortunately, it still looks crap.
Yeah, it does. Another thing that looks crap. Anyway, back in the laboratory, the Doctor realises that he's made a fundamental mistake by using the wrong kind of heat-conducting material, and he's broken the second law of thermodynamics, which he's quite annoyed at himself about. Of course, it's not him at all. It's the Rani that's made this mistake. She asks him if it would have worked if they changed the material. And he says that she should know. After all, she's read all the works of C.P. Snow, who obviously wrote about thermodynamics. The Rani says that she must have forgotten, but the Doctor remembers that Mel has a photographic memory, and he basically, another one of his mixed metaphors or whatever, he says that a kangaroo never forgets. He then goes over to the locked door that he's been worrying about. He has some kind of stethoscope that he takes from his jacket, I guess. He's kind of listening at this locked door.
So we then rejoin Mel and Icona, who have reached the Rani's citadel. Mel believes the Doctor is in there. She imagines he's been kidnapped. According to Icona, building that citadel costs the lives of many Lycurgians. Back to the Doctor in the Rani's lab, he thinks, using his sort of stethoscope thing, that he's heard something caged behind the door. The Rani, dressed as Mel, distracts him with some chat about replacing the plastics that were burnt out in the equipment. The Doctor favours the biodegradable PHB and decides that he's going to look for some sugar and starch to ferment some. But the Rani says she can get the alternative PES from the Lycurgians. She sort of runs off and leaves the laboratory, hits a button and locks the Doctor in.
Mm. Outside, Icona and Mel encounter Faroon, played by Wanda Bentham, who of course is a Doctor Who stalwart, having appeared in Image of Fendar. And she was also in the Faceless ones, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was in there with Donald Pickering, yeah. And interestingly, she's the mother of Benedict Cumberbatch, who is currently playing Sherlock to great acclaim.
Indeed. Icona and Faroon greet each other. She kind of berates him for cutting himself off from the rest of the Lycurgians, ignoring Baez's instructions. Icona comes back with that Baez is basically collaborating, but she says that, you know, he's a hostage and he doesn't have any choice. Mel then kind of joins in, and she and Icona explain to Faroon that Sarn has been killed. They sort of indicate the skeleton. But then it transpires that Sarn was the daughter of Faroon and Baez. And kind of Mel goes over to her and sort of apologises for sort of breaking it to her so abruptly. And she's kind of crying, isn't she, over the skeleton.
Yeah, disappointingly, Wanda Bentham used a tear-inducing liquid to produce her tears in this scene. Maybe she wasn't feeling it in time in the run.
Faroon says that she must go to Baez, and she sort of heads off, leaving Mel and Icona, who appear to sort of follow her, don't they?
Well, Mel believes that the Doctor's going to be in there with Baez, doesn't she? At which point we see Rani leaving the Citadel, presumably to go out and find some of this PES. The Doctor can't break the code to escape from the lab. There's a little kind of number pad next to it, or each door, isn't there, and he can't break the code to get out. So he decides to play the spoons.
Well, why wouldn't you?
I've whiled away many a second by playing the spoons. At the end of playing the spoons, he whacks himself on the back of the head to hilarious comic effect.
I had to pause it for several hours while I prevented my sides from splitting.
Yes, he put on an extra thick corset. So a pointless and crap scene, that one.
I think you hit the nail on the head there.
Thanks, mate. Do you admire my concision?
Mel and Icona watch as Faroon enters the Citadel, and she just walks in straight past one of the tetraps, who kind of lets her pass. Icona then says that he'll draw the tetrap away so that Mel can get inside. And sure enough, the tetrap is drawn away and goes kind of lumbering off after Icona. And he spots what he thinks is Mel, and he fires his sparkly net over there, doesn't he? It's the Rani.
Yeah, sparkly net is not a euphemism for anything.
Fires his sparkly net over the Rani. I don't think she's going to be less pleased, is she?
No. Of course, he hasn't seen the Rani dressed up as Mel before. The real Mel enters the lab, and after a bit of them sort of missing each other, she eventually encounters the Doctor. Of course, she doesn't know who he is, and he, of course, thinks she's a Rani. So they kind of grapple, and she very easily throws the Doctor over, which doesn't really inspire you with much confidence in the new Doctor to be thrown over by a friend of Wayne Sleep. It's not that impressive, is it? While they're sort of grappling, she says, what have you done with the doctor? And rather than just saying, I'm the doctor, of course, the doctor says, he's here. And then she says, where? Under the carpet. Of course, there is no carpet in the Rani's laboratory, which makes a feeble line even worse.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor eventually says he is the doctor, but of course Mel doesn't believe him. The doctor kind of turns the tables and picks her up and whirls her around above his head. And he puts her down and accuses her of being the Rani and pulls her scarlet tresses, thinking it's a wig. And of course, it causes her great pain because, sadly for her, that's her real hair.
A shame. The Rani, meanwhile, is picking herself up and removing this wire net from her, helped by Urak, who's very apologetic, saying that he hadn't seen her dressed like Mel before. Her wig's a bit all over the place, isn't it? So she's having to readjust that, and stamps away grumpily, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. A word on the name Urak. This is quite a sort of a creepy sort of obsequious sort of creature, isn't he? He's always sort of greasing up to the Rani. Mm. Apparently, Pippa Jane Baker got his name from the highly obsequious Uriah Heep from Charles Dickens' David Copperfield. Quite a nice derivation, I suppose. A pretty crap character.
Yeah, they seem to have put quite a lot of effort into this, or parts of this script, haven't they? Unfortunately, when you look at the whole, it's dire, but never mind.
It is, yeah. The Doctor and Mel are still arguing about their respective identities in the Rani's lab. He says if she wants to see the Rani, she should look in the mirror. The face of evil, he says, name-checking a far superior Doctor Who story. And once again, she says what the audience has been thinking, and says, I've had enough of this drivel. Haven't we all, love?
Yeah. He wants to feel her pulse to prove that she's a Time Lord, i.e. the Rani. There's the mention of carrot juice, isn't there? She says it was the real Doctor's favourite drink, which of course it wasn't. And McCoy says no, so he hates it. She's kind of taken aback by that a bit, and she asks if he is the Doctor, why does he look so different? And he explains that he's regenerated. And then they feel each other's pulses, finally.
Woohoo!
Obviously there's a double pulse on the Doctor and only a single one on her, so he accepts that she's Mel and she accepts she's the Doctor. It doesn't quite figure, really, does it, that that would be the case?
No, well, all it proves is that he's a Time Lord or someone else, some other race with double heart, and she's a human, or some other race with a single pulse. Thank Christ that, well, that's over, though, to be honest.
To be fair, it's just really annoying. And they finally accept that each other is who they say they are. She can't believe he's so different, you know, he's completely different than he was before. And he says that he's been a real fool to have been taken in by the Rani, and that doesn't bode well for his seventh persona.
Yeah, it gets all melancholy again, isn't it?
Mm.
At this point we see Rani walking through the quarry. She gets to a shiny pyramid tent TARDIS, doesn't she? She won't let Urak in. Although he's interested to go in there and have a look round. But back to the Doctor, he's explaining a strange matter to Mel. It's an incredibly dense form of matter. He notices that the asteroid that he can see on the Rani screen is made of strange matter, and if it were to explode, it would send a blast of gamma rays equivalent to that of a supernova. He then gives Mel the stethoscope so she can have a listen to the locked doors, and she hears a giant heartbeat through them.
Mm. She wants to hightail it back to the TARDIS. It's just rubbish. I mean, her character is awful, and it's really badly played as well. There's nothing good about it.
And badly scripted.
It's just awful. Anyway, the Doctor's trying to open the door to get out of the laboratory. There's a kind of keypad, and he's trying to guess the combination. From the other side, Baius and Faroon are there, and they can hear the Doctor and Mel talking. And Baius basically gives him the combination, 953.
Well, he hears the Doctor is saying that he can't leave the Lycurgians in the hands of the nasty Rani, doesn't he? So they think, all right, we can trust him, let's give him the combination.
Yeah, basically the Doctor says that 953 is obvious, it's his age and that of the Rani, and the door opens. It just annoyed me as well, really. How does the Doctor count his years? Are these Earth years?
Well, it's different every time, isn't it? I mean, at one point, John Pertwee said he was thousands of years old, didn't he? None of it adds up.
No, it doesn't add up, but I just wonder, what does it mean? Because, you know, it's like 953, what?
rels. As a rel is a, bizarrely approximately a second.
Yeah, I think he's older than 953 seconds.
He looks older than that, doesn't he?
He does. Anyway, I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of that one this time. Inside the Rani's TARDIS, which is very underwhelming, isn't it?
Well, it's entirely rendered by CSO, isn't it? They couldn't be bothered to make a set for it.
Anyway, she's found a piece of this PS. It's kind of an orange plasticky thing, isn't it? And it's kind of a regular shape. And she uses some kind of laser to shape it so that when she's done this, it comes out as a kind of oblong shape, doesn't it? And then she joins Urak outside and orders him to find Mel before she finds the Doctor. A bit late for that, I think.
Too late came the cry. Speaking of Mel, she's having a look in the... I was going to call it the cabinet room, but... It gives the wrong connotation, really. She sees the room containing cabinets containing geniuses, and she sees one containing Hypatia, who is a scholar from ancient Greece, and she sees the one with Einstein. The Doctor's sort of ruminating all this, and he realizes she's collected the greatest creative minds and the most powerful matter in the universe. He does the usual wishing that she'd redirected her talents for good rather than evil. But, Mel sees a cabinet with the Doctor's name on it.
It's strange how these, you know, the greatest talents in the universe, but they're all from Earth, but the Doctor.
Yeah, apparently in the script they were going to be from different planets, but they couldn't be bothered to realise that when it came to...
They just couldn't be arsed.
Quite frankly, yeah.
Yeah, they wonder why, you know, she wants the Doctor. Mel points out that he's a Time Lord, and they both come to the conclusion that it's because he's got a unique understanding of time.
Yeah, but so is the Rani, presumably.
Yeah, but as we find out a bit later, she doesn't want to plug herself in, does she?
True.
Anyway, they go back into the lab. They ask Baos if he knows what's behind the locked door, but he doesn't. And then the Doctor asks him why he's collaborating, and he says he's got no choice. This seems to happen about three or four times, doesn't it? In various episodes.
They continually ask him that, don't they?
It's like, don't you feel really bad about collaborating? Well, I haven't got any choice.
I'm doing it for my people. About you collaborating. Why are you doing it? I'm doing it for my people. It's on and on, doesn't it?
Yeah. They hear the Rani returning, and the Doctor basically ushers everybody out of the room, but he remains himself. When the Rani enters, she notices that the monitor is still on. She asks the Doctor why. He says that he was trying to jog his memory. And then they start to put this PS into the machine.
The Rani's beginning to get suspicious at this point, isn't she? That she might be found out, and she says that the Doctor's adept at manoeuvring. Of course he is, and in fact, the Seventh Doctor gets very adept at manoeuvring as time goes on, doesn't he? But the Doctor kind of says that he can't really go on without knowing what's behind the famous locked door at the top of the steps. And the Rani just basically refuses to tell him. So the Doctor asks her about the pink goo that's sort of in this pyramid that he's kind of looked and remarked on before. The Rani's had enough by this stage, hasn't she? She can't really keep the pretense on any longer, so she hits the control and the lights dim, and she says that she knows, that the Doctor knows, and she takes her wig off, basically, doesn't she? Yeah. But saying that it doesn't matter, the Doctor still has another role to play. Then there's this appalling moment, isn't there, where the Doctor does a sort of, look behind you, and she looks behind her, and he sort of lassoes her with his scarf, and throws her onto the sort of bench and runs off.
That's just feeble in the extreme, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's pathetic. She doesn't even try to struggle, does she?
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't had time to knot the scarf or anything. It's hard to see how it's actually kind of round her, how it's kind of staying there. But as it turns out, she's in hot pursuit. But anyway, he runs and goes down into the sort of tetrap dungeon, doesn't he, to hide. She follows, but yeah, she's a bit tentative because she knows what's down there. She can't find him, so she leaves and locks the hatch behind her. So the Doctor emerges from his hiding place behind one of these upside-down hanging tet-traps. He sort of prances around, doesn't he, on tiptoes, trying not to wake up any of these creatures. He's soon kind of surrounded by them, isn't he? They're kind of closing him a bit, block the entrance, and he sort of concentrates on his face, and that's the end of the episode, isn't it? Quite amusingly, McCoy himself remarked of this scene after he'd filmed it, "That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever done." This from a man who used to bang nails into his nose and stick ferrets down his trousers. At this point, Jonathan Turner responds from the gallery, "You ain't seen nothing yet." So I can't help feeling that Jonathan Turner was trying to sabotage the program at this point. He doesn't want to be on it, does he? And all his ideas are awful to anyone with any level of sanity. He seems to delight in the sort of ridiculous nature of what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know.
Though he has, he's on record for saying he doesn't want to be seen as the man who killed Doctor Who.
Well, it's well known that he wanted to leave, and he'd been wanting to leave for a while, and they basically forced him to stay, and with an ultimatum saying, you know, either you stay and make another series, or another series won't get made. So I don't agree with you, really. I think he loved the show. I think this is a terrible story, but I think things get better after this. He's there for 3 more years, and in those 3 years, there's some really good stuff. And yeah, there's some bad bits in this, most of which is there because he wanted it in, but I don't think it's because he was trying to sabotage the show, no way.
Well, maybe there are sort of lapses in taste or whatever. I can't help feeling that would be something to do with the fact that he resents at this point being on the show. Maybe he got back into it again.
Yeah, I think this one was put together, you know, it was a rush job, wasn't it? I mean, like you said, Andrew Cartmell's on board, but he's new to the job. He didn't really have much input into this. You know, you've got a new doctor, you don't really know how he's going to turn out. I think once things settled down a bit and he realised that Cartmell had some good ideas and the doctor was actually going to be good in the end, I think he probably thought, well, it's not so bad.
And maybe Cartmell's making more of these kind of decisions. Although Jonathan Turner is responsible for the tone of the show, isn't he? Ins and outs of it, Cartmell will have a lot more to do with how the scripts are realised. So maybe this is just an unfortunate moment for Jonathan Turner.
And it's definitely unfortunate.
It's unfortunate for everyone, but and he's not producing his best. So yeah, charitably, maybe we should leave it at that.
Mm. We're into part three, which opens with some awful eye gags from the Doctor. Can we not see eye to eye, etc., etc. Anyway, but this time Baius comes to the rescue and he opens the trapdoor and pours some more of the goo into the trough, which distracts the tetraps and allows the two of them to escape. The Rani, meanwhile, has gone outside, checking outside the citadel, presumably for the doctor, and she's being watched by Mel and Faroon. Mel tells Faroon she mustn't be caught with her and advises that she leaves her, which reluctantly Faroon does.
I've got a bit of a problem with this scene. Well, I've had a problem with the Rani finding a red fright wig and the exact clothes that Mel is wearing in order to masquerade as her, for one thing. Also, if you're trying to chase someone and find them when they've escaped, do you have time to change during that process? Because she's back in a sort of red outfit, isn't she, at this point?
Yes, you're right, yeah. I mean, she'd take the wig off, hadn't she? We saw her do that, but yeah, changing the outfit.
He's getting away. Quick, let me change my outfit.
It doesn't quite work, does it?
Bizarre, isn't it? Anyway, back in the cabinet room, the doctor tries and fails to shake Baius's hand to thank him for saving him from the tetraps, and then dashes off. Baius manages to stop him from going the way that the Rani went and suggests he takes the route through the lab instead. But the doctor runs in and finds Urak plodding about. At this point, we don't know what happens to the doctor, but he kind of disappears. But Urak appears in the cabinet room and basically insults Baius and his race before wandering out outside, casually insulting him. Mm. And then Baius opens one of his cabinets and the doctor pops out. There's another question about why Baius is collaborating, and he says his people are under threat. I don't know why the characters in this story don't understand it, or whether they think the audience hasn't understood this yet. But
they haven't said it this episode, so that's why.
There are several seconds since it's been mentioned. Anyway, he says if he can get there, the doctor will find the answer to Baius's obedience to the Rani in the centre of leisure, or the leisure centre, if you will.
Yes, the doctor then shows Baius the strange matter asteroid on the scanner, doesn't he? And then he removes the microthermistor from the machine. Baius is annoyed at this, actually, because he probably thinks that the Rani, you know, will think that he had something to do with it. He tries to get the doctor to put it back. and they have a bit of a set to, don't they? The Doctor trips him up and more or less knocks him out, really. He takes the microthermistor and runs just as the Rani returns.
Quite nicely, he apologises to Baez, doesn't he, before he runs off, saying he didn't mean to hurt him, which is quite a nice moment, I think. The Rani appears at this point, doesn't she, and he quickly interrogates Baez and basically is annoyed at him for letting the Doctor go, and she very feebly kicks him.
Yeah.
Apparently, Kate O'Mara didn't think that that was something that the Rani would do, and she didn't want to kick Donald Pickering.
Mm.
So what you've got is a kick designed not to hurt a fly.
Yeah, you think, well, why did you bother doing it at all?
Yeah, they might as well just left it out. But anyway, she then wanders off and activates a sort of alarm klaxon, doesn't she?
Mm. Outside, Ikona watches as the Doctor runs out of the Rani's lair. And then we get a tetrap jumping out at Mel, who, of course, screams, and she turns, and then Urek appears from the other side, sort of trapping her. She screams some more, and then Urek leans in for a love bite.
He does, doesn't he?
Which seems to freeze her, doesn't it? She basically goes very rigid, and the other tetrap picks her up and heads back towards the sister with her.
I think women tend to go rigid when you try and kiss them, don't they, Martin?
Yes, that's because...
It's because of your forked tongue.
Yes, they do. But enough about me. The Doctor, meanwhile, is picking his way through the rocks, and he hears Ikona's voice telling him to stop. Ikona says that he must be the Doctor, and he tells him that he's already met Mel. And then he tells the Doctor to look down. The Doctor looks down, and his foot is basically right underneath the tripwire, isn't it? Which is about to set off, and he gingerly removes it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then a tetrap arrives, menacing the Doctor. Ikona pulls out his gun and shoots it with his sparkly metal bits, which kind of disorientates it a bit, and it comes near to the Doctor, who pushes it basically onto this tripwire, activating the bubble, which immediately explodes on the cliff face. Almost Colin Baker-ish in the Doctor directly causing the death of a alien creature.
The only difference here is that the Doctor seems to regret what he's done, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, he takes his hat off, doesn't he?
Yeah, but his face, when he sees the bubble trap, he's horrified. He looks like he didn't know it was going to happen.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's slightly removed from Colin Baker, but maybe it's put in there deliberately to show that they're different.
Mm.
Mind you, another tetrap is taking Mel into the Citadel. The Rani tells Faroon to tell the Doctor that he can have Mel back in return for the microthermistor. The Rani believes that the Doctor's going to make contact with the other Lacertians to basically stir up some sort of rebellion. Baez encourages Faroon to obey the Rani for their people's sake, and once again underlining that point. He says basically that the Rani's nearly done what she needs to do, and she's so close to leaving that it's not worth the risk, you know, to try and disobey her at this point in the game. He sort of fondly imagines that she'll leave and all that their lives will return back to normal. Of course, Faroon reminds her that Sarn won't be there, so life will probably be slightly better.
Mm.
But Baez then tells Faroon that the Doctor is going to be in the leisure centre. He's probably on a treadmill or, you know, using the excellent cafe facilities.
Yeah, actually, Ikona and the Doctor are at the leisure centre. They arrive at the front gate, which looks very much like the Citadel from the outside, doesn't it?
It does a bit, yeah.
The Doctor notices that the Lacertians can come and go freely. You know, they're kind of wandering in and out. And Ikona says that provided they don't go anywhere near the Rani's lab and that they obey the orders of Baez, then they can do whatever they like.
It seems that the Lacertian custom is to touch this rock on the way into the leisure centre. You see them all doing it, and Ikona does it as he leads the way in, and the Doctor does it, and that somehow manages to hurt his hand on it. And this is one of the things that Sylvester McCoy is trying to do, is add little bits of sort of comic business into what he did. He realises now that his original portrayal was too comic, and he got a lot darker and took these sort of comic bits out, mercifully. But it's difficult to see how the Doctor actually hurt his hand on this fairly smooth-looking rock.
Inside the leisure centre, the Kershans basically are lounging around a pool, aren't they? Up above them, there's this kind of beehive-like thing, isn't there, hanging from the ceiling? It's kind of spherical, metallic, globe-type thing.
Yeah, it's a cross between a sort of wasp nest and a glitter ball, if that can be imagined.
Yeah. There's also some rubbish music playing in the background. And Icona's fairly scathing about the other Lycurgians, isn't he? He says that here they have all their wishes granted, basically. They've all become very indolent and lazy, and they just kind of lounge around all day doing nothing. A bit like me, really. The Doctor's trying to figure out what it is that Baeus meant when he said he'd find the answer here. So he asks Icona if he knows there's anything different from when he was last here, and he says the only thing is the beehive, which he describes as a pointless embellishment. Icona then recognises somebody, which turns out to be his brother Lanisha. They greet each other, and he asks him if he knows what this beehive thing is. But Lanisha basically says that they've been forbidden to talk to him because he's not obeying Baeus.
The Rani asks Baeus if he recognises the foil fragments that have been collected from the last time Icona discharged his gun. He says they came from the fireworks they used to have at their carnivals.
Mm.
She doesn't buy this. She says that they were fired from a gun aimed at a tetrap. Baeus says none of his followers would have done this. But she says, oh, well, he didn't say no Lycurgian would have done it. So she goes to a screen and brings up an image of the globe from the leisure centre. You can see Baeus beginning to panic a bit, saying that she'll be punishing the innocent. But she says she's warned him of the consequences of subversion. And she presses a button. Back at the leisure centre, some terrifying green blobs emerge from the globe with some foley buzzing noises put on in the background. Mm. These are supposedly a load of killer insects that have been released from the sort of cells that make up this globe. You can see three Lycurgians get killed by them, and all the others run off in panic. Interestingly, it's only Mark Greenstreet as Icona who remembers to run like a Lycurgian, with his arms flapping backwards.
Yeah.
But his brother Lanisha is killed. Faroon sits over him, sort of mourning, but then tells the Doctor that she has a message for him.
When the insects first appear, someone shouts out, "Look out, they kill," even though they've never seen them before.
Oh, yeah, have they not been used until this point?
Well, no, nobody knows what it is, do they? You know, Arcana's not seen it, and nobody...
Oh, yeah, that is true.
Yeah.
There's some terrible dubs here. That "Look out, they kill" is dubbed on afterwards, isn't it? And... Mm. So is the Doctor saying killer insects. It's then dubbed on again after Lanisha is killed. So the Doctor turns his back and he says killer insects again. But the quality and volume of the dub is completely wrong for the rest of the scene. So clearly a dub that it doesn't work at all.
No. The other thing I was going to point out was this globe thing is obviously some kind of hive, isn't it? Mm. And this is the leisure centre, so it's a leisure hive, isn't it?
Hey! A reference to a slightly superior story.
Yes.
Just a bit about the realisation of these insects. It couldn't be worse, could it? It's just literally some green blobs post-production. It's just awful, isn't it?
Mm. It's almost as good as the green eyes in the Vengeance on Varos scene.
Yeah, and just as terrifying.
Meanwhile, back in the Batcave, Mel is hanging upside down, isn't she? Amongst the tetraps. And then we cut to Urak bringing Mel outside into the quarry where there's a kind of standoff with the Doctor and Icona. There's going to be an exchange, isn't there? And the Doctor takes the microthermistor from his jacket and hands it to Icona, who walks forward towards Urak and Mel and places it on a rock. And the Doctor then calls for Mel to come forward. And Urak kind of waves at her to start walking, which she does. And as she starts walking, Urak kind of scuffles along behind her and snaffles the microthermistor. And then he basically has a go at the Doctor for being stupid and not a worthy opponent for the Rani.
Yeah.
And the Doctor's wondering what he's on about. You know, Mel continues to walk towards his outstretched arms and then basically this vanishes. And he realises that she was a hologram and he throws his hat to the floor in disgust, doesn't he?
Yeah, if you can produce a hologram that's that convincing, why do you have to dress up as Mel?
Well, I think, you know, if he couldn't use a hologram to interact totally with him like she was pretending to be male, though, could he?
Well, maybe not, but...
I think that would have been a bit too much.
That whole masquerading as male was probably unnecessary anyway.
Oh, yeah, it probably was.
But anyway, I mean, you're probably right. I mean, the male hologram seems to be walking a little bit jerkily, doesn't she?
Mm.
But that might be how Bonnie Langford walks, I don't know.
Maybe she had a veruca.
I hope she was wearing a veruca sock.
Over her face.
Preferably, yeah. Over her mouth, certainly. I mean, it was a clunky dialogue.
Incessant screaming.
Yes, that too. Anyway, back in the Tetrap dungeon.
The Batcave,
that's much better, isn't it? Mm. Back in the Batcave, Commissioner Gordon has... back in the Batcave, a Tetrap takes the real Mel down from where she was hanging and heads upstairs with her. Meanwhile, the Rani is telling Baez to increase brain stimulation. he's a bit worried this is going to take it over the danger level. The Rani's insistent that she can't miss the solstice. She's probably a fan of Hawkwind. Baez says that computer control needs constant monitoring and he can't do it on his own. But the Rani says she's providing a computer expert to help him, and the rigid form of Mel is brought in. The Rani breaks some smelling salts under her nose, and Mel comes out of her paralysis.
She basically tells Baez that Mel is now his responsibility. And Mel, she's just dreadful. Yurek walks past, and she gives a little shriek, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's seen enough of them so far to stop screaming every time she sees one, surely.
Dear. Arcada and the Doctor, meanwhile, are heading back towards the Citadel. The Rani starts her machine up, doesn't she? But then she realises that the extra brain stimulation isn't enough, and there's, you know, she's still in danger of missing the solstice. They say this about 500 times as well, don't they?
Mm.
Yurek suggests to Rani that she put herself into the cabinet, as the, you know, the Doctor's not there. She can take his place, and he, i.e. Yurek, could operate the machine for her. You know, his deviousness is coming through a bit more here, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
She's basically far from amused by that, isn't she?
Yeah, which makes sense, as you say, of the whole reason that she had to get another Time Lord in there rather than just doing it herself.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe there are ways of using her intelligence without being enslaved to the machine. But she tells Baez to prepare the Doctor's cabinet. And then something quite... I mean, Mel is quite bad so far in this, isn't she? As you said.
She's quite good, I thought.
But something happens to the way that Pip and Jane Baker write for her from here on in. She suddenly comes up with the most unlikely dialogue and most unnatural dialogue you've ever heard.
Mm.
I'll just pluck a few things out of this scene. He's shrewder than you think. Underestimating the Doctor is a common fault. He's got qualities you'll never have. Something I'd call humanity. I could nominate a few candidates for extermination myself. None of those are remotely natural ways of speaking. And once you've got Bonnie Langford's sort of musical theatre-style delivery for a TV audience, it's awful.
It is.
But Mel appears to be suddenly like that. I mean, the dialogue's not that bad until this point. And she's suddenly awful for about an episode, or maybe even to the end. Yeah, actually to the end, because the final line she says... to Icona is awful as well. So it just something terrible happens at this point.
I think it happened long before this, but yeah.
A new fresh hell is released.
Something terrible happened when she was cast.
That was John Nathan Turner as well.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, the Doctor and Icona are still approaching the Citadel, as they were a bit earlier.
It's a long walk from the leisure centre. Yeah. You normally get a bus.
Yeah, the Doctor notices that there's a rocket on top of the building, doesn't he? And he says that it's got a fixed trajectory, although how I can tell that from afar, I don't know. He supposes that it must be aimed at the asteroid and figures out from that that there must be a fixed time for it to be fired. And that leads him to think that it must be the solstice. So decides he must get back into the lab and see what's behind that sealed door. He asks Icona if he can divert the Tetraps again. Icona doesn't think it's going to work a second time, but he runs off anyway.
Have a care, Doctor.
And sure enough, the Tetrap that's on guard is drawn away and starts running after him. But as the Doctor approaches the door, another one comes out. I think it's Urak. And the Doctor turns, but the first tetrap has doubled back and basically has been trapped.
So the Doctor's surrounded by tetraps again. No time for any gags about numbers of eyes, because Urak pokes his tongue out. And I suppose we're led to believe, particularly what we've seen later, that he gets zapped on the neck in the same way that young Bonnie Langford was.
Oh, he gives a love bite to the Doctor, does he?
He does, yeah. He doesn't care who he does. Anything with a pulse or two pulses.
The more pulses, the better.
He's desperate for someone with nine hearts. So Mel says to Baius, why don't they get the Doctor's cabinet machine to blow a fuse? Baius says that that's pointless, and at least the cabinet will keep the Doctor alive when he's in it. And then Mel is given the line, don't try to reason me into compliance, which I think I said the other day to somebody.
I could, you know, if I had a pound for every time I said that,
you'd have no money.
I'd be penniless.
Yes. So at this point, the paralysed Doctor is brought in. So, yeah, he's clearly been love-bitten. A very daft face from McCoy, I think, at this point. Look at me, I'm paralysed face. Mm. Urak tells Baius to connect the Doctor to the main input. Mel puts up a sort of mild fight, but Baius tells her to obey for the usual reasons. So the Doctor's now stuck in the cabinet, and Baius tells Mel to set the temperature gauge. She refuses, which makes you wonder why Baius just didn't do it himself. And he says, stubbornness will not help the Doctor. And she says, and putting him in here will. That's some twisted philosophy, if you like. Which, again, I'm sure I said to somebody the other day.
It's dreadful, isn't it? And then the Rani comes out of the lab and gives Baius some more instructions. She goes back into the lab and finally opens the sealed door.
Hooray!
Climbs up the steps into a room. Mel creeps along behind her and follows her into this room. And inside there's a big brain.
A massive brain.
And it's basically talking mumbo-jumbo to itself, isn't it? It's the voices of the geniuses who are kind of rattling off some scientific nonsense. The brain says that its knowledge of time is at a very primitive stage, and the Rani kind of responds by saying it won't be once the Doctor is introduced. And she drags Mel out of the room, hands her over to Baius. Urak's tagging along behind, and he grabs hold of Mel and thankfully puts his hand over her mouth so that he can't hear her screaming.
Hooray! You can hear muffled screaming, which is slightly better than the usual.
Yeah. The Rani orders Baius to root the Doctor into the brain, which he does, and the power starts to build. And the Rani runs back into the brain room, and the brain starts saying things like, the barrier to understanding time is empirical thinking. And the Rani starts to smile in triumph. And then you get a shot of the Doctor in his cabinet, and he starts kind of shaking, and you can see his mouth moving, he's kind of muttering. He's got this kind of helmet thing on his head, isn't he? And then Mel screams, funnily enough. And then you get another shot of the brain, and then the Doctor superimposed over the brain. And then another close-up of the Doctor in his capsule. And then the episode ends. I just think it's a right mess, to be honest.
It's a bit of a jumble, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a shame, because I think, you know, it could have been quite an effective ending, but it's just all jumbled up, and it's a mess.
Well, the other thing is, we don't actually know what the Rani's trying to do, do we? You know, obviously, it's not good that the Doctor's been plugged into this thing, and that, you know, the big brain there with loads of geniuses channeled into it is probably not good if the Rani's in charge. But we don't know what she's trying to do. So, you know, the jeopardy for this cliffhanger is pretty sort of meaningless, really.
Mm. Yeah, that's true, actually. You know, although it's kind of built up that it's a big climax. Yeah, like you say, at this point, well, yeah, and what happens next?
Yeah. So the Rani's going to win, but what is she going to win? It's a meaningless cliffhanger, really.
Yeah.
If you pare it down to, you know, to what we know so far in the story.
True.
But yeah, I mean, it's just awful. I mean, the only saving grace is that Peter Tudnam is one of the voices, who of course is the Blake 7 voice, is the go-to guy, isn't he, for Blake 7 computer voice.
Yeah.
Zen, Aurak, and Slave, played by Peter Tudnam. And as we found out in the Ark in Space. He was the voice there, wasn't he?
Yeah.
This is a sterile area. Keep out!
Yes. Excellent.
It was a brilliant moment. It's a very Aurak voice he uses in this one, isn't it?
Mm.
So, into part four. So this is where we get the earlier edit of the title sequence that I was talking about earlier. So a slightly less distinct Sylvester McCoy face and no wink.
Mm. I think it's a much less distinct face.
Well, it never actually reaches full face, does it?
No.
It's not distinct enough. So that's a good improvement from J&T, but the wink clearly is not.
No.
Didn't you think that after that sort of crescendo at the end of part three, it just sort of fizzles out, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
People just sort of walk off and then have a chat. Jurek reminds Rani that time's short, if they're going to be ready for the solstice, and she says, yeah, I know. And it's just everything has just sort of collapsed after this great crescendo.
Yeah, outside there's a Tetrep patrolling around and Icona comes out of hiding, and that's about it. And then Jurek is saying to the Rani that he wants to release all the insects and kill all the Kershans, but the Rani says that she may still need them if anything goes wrong with her experiment. So selective retribution will suffice. And the Rani hands Jurek a metal case, and then we see him go off to the Batcave where he gets all of the Tetraps to follow him out. And we see them pass Baeus and Mel in the corridor, don't they? And they kind of leave the Citadel en masse.
Yes, indeed. Mel, with Baeus, is saying that she thinks Arani has reckoned without one thing, the Doctor's character. Another natural line. Baeus seems unconvinced by this. And then we switch to the Doctor in the cabinet, where McCoy is giving it 11 out of 10 on the gurning front. It's a bit crappy, isn't it?
Mm.
Rani checks on the brain, and she finds that the Doctor's spouting nonsense, and he's sort of putting the other geniuses off, isn't he? Getting him to sort of strange parallel arguments by talking rubbish. The Rani sort of says, "I'll kill him," and runs down the steps to go and disconnect him.
Mm. Blessed are the pie makers, as they will make light pastry.
Yeah, I quite like that bit. She complains to Mel that he's provoked multiple schizophrenia in the geniuses. The Rani turns her back, doesn't she, to operate her communication bracelet thing. Mel opens the cabinet and the Doctor jumps out and they bundle the Rani into the cabinet. Mel wants to turn it on to give her a taste of her own medicine, but the Doctor disagrees, saying two wrongs don't make a left turn.
Mm. Yeah, and they basically close her in there, don't they? She starts bashing on the perspex angrily.
Yes.
It looks like if she gave it a good whack, it'd probably break in half.
Like it would, yeah. Much to the annoyance of the props team.
Yes. The Doctor and Mel go back to the big brain.
Yeah, just as they enter the brain room, Mel comes out with another awful line. She says, "Before this regeneration, you were keen on cats, and you know what curiosity did to them." Awful.
The Doctor checks on the rocket, and then there's this kind of control panel by a monitor screen, and there's this kind of rollerball thing, and he says, "He who dares spins." he spins this roller, and the screen shows a supernova exploding, doesn't it? Mm. Which kind of gives him some idea of what she's trying to do.
So meanwhile, the Tetraps storm the leisure centre. They're not wearing hoodies or anything, I suppose, I know, but...
They'd never get them over their ears, would they?
They wouldn't, no. They'd still be seen by the CCTV cameras.
You could probably pick them out easily in a lineup as well, couldn't you?
Probably, yeah. I would think so. They're the only ones without tattoos. So the Tetraps kind of surround the Lacertians, and they fit these ankle bracelets to them, don't they?
Mm.
And they don't really know what's going on, but Jurek demonstrates their purpose on one of the Lacertians. He turns his control and the Lacertian screams, falls over and turns into a skeleton.
Mm. Baeus, meanwhile, is passing the Rani, who's in this cubicle, cabinet, whatever you want to call it. She sees him and tells him to let her out. He basically ignores her to start with, doesn't he? But funnily enough, she threatens his people's lives and he realises he hasn't really got a choice.
Maybe it's him that keeps needing to be reminded. Oh, it's absurd, isn't it?
Yeah. There we see the Tetraps leaving the leisure centre. And then we're back with the Doctor and Mel in the brain room. The Doctor says that the only thing capable of exploding strange matter is strange matter itself. And then they're kind of trying to figure out what's going on, and they come to the conclusion that the Rani must be trying to use the brain to come up with a lightweight substitute for strange matter, you know, to enable her to explode it. And then the Doctor wonders why the Rani risks going so close to a supernova to film the thing on the monitor. And he thinks there must be some deeper motive.
Which indeed there is. The Rani appears, and the Doctor suddenly appears to work out what that motive is, doesn't he? He suddenly, from nowhere, realises the Rani wants to reproduce helium-2 using the strange matter. This is one of the things I don't like about Sylvester McCoy's portrayal is the rolling R.
He's rolling R's?
Yes, you shouldn't roll your R's on a family show.
No.
Yeah, that's one of the first examples of it in full effect. But the Rani explains that after the explosion, helium-2 will fuse with the atmosphere under Kershaw and form a shell of chronons, which are discrete particles of time, which sounds a bit unlikely but to me, but then I'm not a nuclear physicist. The brain will then go into some sort of overdrive until the gap between the shell and the planet is filled, and this apparently will create a time manipulator capable of dominating and controlling time anywhere in the cosmos.
Seems likely, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's that easy. So the Doctor's absolute horror that she'll be able to change the order of creation, and the Rani says she'll direct evolution in the way that she wants it. She'll return Earth to the Cretaceous Age to give the dinosaurs a second chance to fulfil their potential. what is in it for her, I don't know.
Some really bizarre, convoluted plan, isn't it? That doesn't seem to have any real end game.
It's just bizarre, isn't it? The Doctor's, you know, horrified there'll be no Shakespeare, Michelangelo, Louis Pasteur, Elvis, or Mrs. Malaprop. Mrs. Malaprop is fictional, but I suppose she'll never be written. They'll never have existed. But importantly, Urak overhears him saying that all life under Kershaw will be exterminated after the rocket is launched. So Urak starts thinking, oh, well, that might include us Tetraps.
The Doctor says to the Rani that he thought she was a psychopath without murderous intent, and he now withdraws the qualification. The brain pipes up with a kind of computation that it's saying out loud, and it makes an error, which the Doctor corrects, and then he bites his hand. He realises he's helped it to reach its objective. And sure enough, the brain says Eureka. The objective has been achieved. It says Loi Hargil, which is the substance that the Rani needs to substitute for strange matter, which is actually an anagram of Holy Grail.
Yeah, which is why the name sounds so stupid and unlikely.
The Rani's ecstatic that the brain has worked this out, and she's kind of congratulating herself and the brain. The Doctor and Mel take this opportunity to creep out behind her, and they close the door, locking her in. In the lab, though, Urak's there. Mel picks up one of these glitter guns and shoots Urak with it, and he kind of falls immobilized to the floor. And then the two of them rush out past Baez, who comes in and goes over to Urak to see what's happened.
Mel and the Doctor run out of the Citadel, and they bump into Ikona, who's on his way into the Citadel. The Doctor tells him he needs to go back and stir up the Lycurtians into fighting back. Yeah, good luck with that one. Meanwhile, Urak is telling Rani that the Doctor's escaped, but she didn't really care. She says she's got the Loi Hargil that she needed. We sort of see it starting to form, don't we? It's a kind of, almost a kind of conveyor belt. It looks like a kind of mineral, doesn't it, being dropped into these little hoppers and being transported, presumably up into the rocket to be fired at this asteroid.
She says, I have the Loi Hargil. Nothing can stop me now.
Sound familiar?
It does indeed. Back at the leisure centre, Ikona is showing the Doctor these bangles that are on people's legs. Ikona suggests maybe they could cut through it. Mel says, oh, that's a daft idea. It's bound to be booby-trapped. If I was Ikona, I'd just turn around and slap her.
Yeah. Well, daft doesn't seem a strong enough word if it could be booby-trapped and kill the person in it.
Yeah. Anyway, the Doctor pulls out a penknife, actually, doesn't he? And he flicks the top off this bangle, exposing the innards. And he suggests that if they run a wire around the back of the leg and attach it either side, that they would, that would kind of keep the circuit unbroken and they'd be able to remove it. You know, they're wondering where they're going to get some wire from, and I kind of goes over to a handy nearby kaplunk set and pulls out one of the wires.
So they're wildly hours away, don't they, in the leisure centre by playing kaplunk with each other.
And they hand this piece of wire to Mel, who, being the expert in computers, obviously knows how to handle a piece of wire.
It's sort of practical electronics. In fact, it's a fibre optic, isn't it, rather than wire. So unless the whole system works on light rather than electricity, it wouldn't work anyway. It is alien, after all.
Exactly.
Alien tech.
So, she uses this piece of wire, and sure enough, they're able to release the bangle safely. The doctor leaves Icona there to remove the rest of the bangles. Oh, the one that they remove is actually around Faroon's leg, isn't it?
Yeah, no one important then.
No. Yeah, the doctor leaves Icona there, and Faroon reminds the doctor about the insects.
Yeah, the doctor says he has some kind of double bluff up his sleeve, doesn't he? Meanwhile, the Rani decides to watch the Loy Hargill experiment from the safety of her TARDIS, and tells Urek he must stay there and keep an eye on things until after the rocket is launched. Having overheard what the doctor was saying, he doesn't really fancy that task, does he?
No.
As the countdown to the launch is taking place, Mel and Icona start releasing the geniuses from their cabinets. The doctor gives Mel the TARDIS key and tells her to take them back there. Icona hands the doctor his umbrella, which seems a bit trivial, until he gets up into the brain room and reveals that the umbrella is basically closed and it's full of the ankle bracelets they've taken off the Lycursians. And they start fitting them to the rim of the platform that the brain's sitting on. Baeus realizes that time is short and says that he's going to finish the job, despite Faroon's protestations.
Yeah, there's one other thing that happens there. The doctor removes a kind of electric panel, doesn't he? And he makes an adjustment to it. I'm not really sure what he's doing, actually, but he does something, doesn't he?
He's mucking it up for the Rani.
Yeah. As they all leave, the doctor picks up a jar with blue liquid in it and pops it in his pocket. Baeus closes the door to the brain room with himself inside, and the brain continues to count down. It's reached about 7. We then see the Rani just outside her TARDIS. Her kind of wrist device starts bleeping, and she looks at it. She sees that it's stopped at the number 4. And then the doctor appears on sort of the top of a kind of cliff looking down at her, and he tells her that he's aborted the launch and that the Lycursians are about to attack her.
Oh, how scary.
Yeah, but she's shivering in her boots.
Her red stiletto boots.
Yeah. She says to him that you basically just signed their death warrants, and she kind of stabs a button on this wrist device, which, of course, explodes the bangles, but not on their legs. They're around the brain, and it kills Baeus and explodes everything in the room, I guess. Why did Baeus stay behind?
Oh, it's some foolish act of bravery.
But what was he doing?
Well, he was finishing putting the bracelets around before the countdown finished, I think, is the idea behind it. But given the time, how far the Doctor and everyone else have had to escape from the Citadel, I'm sure he would have time to finish it off and get out as well before.
Well, he had, yeah. Because the last thing we saw was him closing the door and locking himself in and just kind of standing there.
So a pointless self-sacrifice.
Yeah, he felt guilty about having collaborated all the time or something.
Well, maybe he's fed up with the script.
Yeah, I'm surprised the whole cast didn't go in there with him.
So, yes, despite this explosion, the countdown continues, actually. It starts again, doesn't it? And the rocket is launched. Quite a decent effect, I thought, this rocket launching.
Yeah, it reminded me of Thunderbirds. And a bit like Blake 7 as well.
I was going to say Blake 7, yeah. It reminded me of the effects they used to use for Scorpio.
Yeah.
In the last series of Blake 7. But it's, yeah, decent model work, actually. That's the only bit of film, because everything else is on video at this stage in the show, isn't it? And it continues to be until it finishes, basically.
Mm.
And it's pretty good when you see the whole Citadel exploding behind it as it's launched. Decent effect. And Rani sees all this and just gets into a TARDIS. And we see it dematerialised, don't we?
Yeah, then we see the rocket approaching the strange matter asteroid, which, again, is a reasonable effect, I thought.
Mm.
And then we're back at just outside the TARDIS, where the Doctor joins Mel and all the Lycursians. And he tells them that the delay in the countdown will mean that the rocket will now miss the asteroid. But he crosses his fingers behind his back, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So he's not entirely certain. But sure enough, the rocket does miss. And then we see the Doctor inside the TARDIS, where there's about a dozen or so of these geniuses. The Doctor kind of ushers them through into another room, doesn't he? Einstein's at the console, looking interested. But the Doctor says that he'll explain it all to him later. He says it's all relative.
It's all relative.
I don't know where these dozen such geniuses were. There's only about four cabinets.
Yeah, they didn't get a lot of screen time, did they? Others?
No.
So then we go back to the usual sort of goodbyes, don't we, outside the TARDIS. And they're all kind of eulogising about Baez's self-sacrifice, and which, as we've discussed, is probably fairly pointless, wasn't it? Icona regrets that the Rani seems to have escaped in a TARDIS. The Doctor has a little smile at this point, doesn't he?
Mm.
We then see the Rani in her CSO TARDIS interior, strung up with a load of tet traps. Urak is on the floor talking to her, telling her that she will show them how to overcome their needs and to basically kind of serve them on their home planet when they arrive back there. Mm. There will be plasma in abundance, which is nice.
That's lovely. Yeah, her TARDIS now appears to have a rocky roof. She didn't have before. So, you know, I don't know how they managed to install that.
Well, maybe the Tetraps bring their rocks with them. Mm. But how did they get in the TARDIS? I don't understand how any of this happened.
Well, how did the Rani get into the Doctor's TARDIS at the start?
Yeah, the TARDIS is a bit of an open door policy in this story.
Anyway, he's kind of goading her a bit, isn't he? And she's struggling and she tries to kick him, doesn't she?
They will, she's really miffed.
All the Tetraps just laugh. And then outside the TARDIS again, where the Doctor hands Icona this jar of blue liquid that he picked up before he left the Rani's lab. And he tells him that it's an antidote to the killer insects. Icona takes it from him. And they just pull it all away. The ungrateful git.
Isn't he?
You know, to gasps of amazement from the other Lycurgians. And then Faroon says that Icona thinks they should meet their own challenges if they are to survive.
Yeah, a bit rubbish, isn't it? You know, something from outside their planet has been brought in and a solution for this thing from outside their planet has been brought in. No, we'll find the solution ourselves, even though we've got it in our hands.
Mm.
No one's going to operate the globe now anyway, so is it still a danger? And these people are killed instantly, aren't they, by these insects? So how's this going to help anybody?
Yeah, I know. It's just a ridiculous kind of stand, isn't it? Pointless stand for absolutely no reason.
Rubbish. Anyway, the Doctor and Mel leave. The Doctor saying time and tide melts the snowman tiresomely. Mel says, it's going to take a while to get used to you. And he says, don't worry, Mel, I'll grow on you. And to be fair, he does.
Mm.
Grow on the audience, and he actually grew on me during the course of this, but blimey, what a terrible start.
Yeah, then again the TARDIS and he doffs his hat and that's it.
Yeah, so word on ratings?
If you must.
I must.
Go on then.
Okay, part one, 5.1 million viewers, down to 4.2, up to 4.3, and then up a little bit to 4.9. More interestingly, if it could be more interesting, the audience appreciation figures, 58% for part one, which is poor, apparently, especially for a drama programme.
Yeah.
Bear in mind that Doctor Who these days is getting between about 84 and 87.
Yeah.
58 ain't good. Part two is slightly better with 63. It was a slightly better episode. But it's down to 57% for the next two episodes. So people really didn't like this.
No, not received.
There is also audience appreciation figures for both Sylvester McCoy and Bonnie Langford, and they're both about 44%, I think I'm right in saying.
Really?
Which is dreadful. That Sylvester McCoy's was never that low again. It was an upward rise from
Bonnie Langford's is never that high again.
No, that was a great day for Bonnie Langford. Yeah, I mean, you can imagine 5.1 people tuning in for part one, and you can imagine, you know, that nearly a million left for part two.
Yeah, but as we've always said, these figures are meaningless. I think the AI is a bit more telling.
It is, yeah, definitely. every episode was against, I think at the time, the most popular soap opera, Coronation Street.
Mm.
The best it achieved for part one was 71st most popular show that week. And then it was around, well, 85th, then 81st, and then 86th most popular show that week. So not at all good. Bear in mind, Doctor Who these days is first, second, or third, generally.
Yeah. Pretty damning stuff.
Isn't it?
Overall views, then?
Well, charitably speaking, it's slightly better than I remembered it, but only just. It does get better from part one onwards. I'm fairly sure I've never actually seen episode three until the first time I watched this twice for this podcast. Purposefully avoided the McCoy era and the latter half of the Colin Baker era ever since. So this was new to me, I think, part three. I'm pretty sure I've never seen that before. Although I do remember part four. So, I was at university at the time and I wasn't watching this stuff. My dad was taping it, but he didn't tape every episode. So I think that might be why. I wasn't desperate to find it by other means, I can tell you. It looks good, except for the tet traps, I would say. And the Lycurgians come to that aren't particularly brilliant. But it looks good, I think. I like the pink sky and I think the outside stuff works well. I think everything else looks pretty good. There's a couple of dodgy effects, which we'll probably come to later, but the regeneration is obviously the key reason for this story, if you like, and that's best forgotten about, really, isn't it? Because I made such a hash of it. The whole Rani disguised as Mel section is amongst the worst scenes ever in Doctor Who, I think. And the script, the dialogue is really, really clunky. We're hearing dialogue that we were talking about in the Vengeance on Varos podcast, the stuff that the Jason Connery character was having to say was stuff that no one would ever say. It's just entirely unnatural, and a lot of this was as well.
Yeah.
Over to you.
Yeah. I think that if you remove Mel from this episode, it would be 100% better. Obviously, okay. By removing her, it would remove quite a bit of the plot with the Rani pretending to be her anyway, but I think she is just absolutely abysmal throughout. And I just find her incredibly difficult to watch. The character isn't any kind of rounded character at all. It just kind of seems to have any random lines. Not believable in any way. Bonnie Langford is dreadful as an actress in it. And she's pathetic, really.
To be honest, for the first couple of parts, I don't think Bonnie Langford's that bad, actually. She wasn't as awful as I remembered until she started screaming incessantly about everything, really, but mainly about the tet traps. She does try too hard, or appears to try too hard. As I said before, her acting, she's miscast, basically, for TV, I think, because her acting style is really musical theatre stuff, isn't it?
Mm.
And she's got that sort of overacted, sort of over-enthusiastic, sort of declamatory style that you get in that kind of stuff. And it doesn't work on screen in something like this. She's in the wrong place, I think.
Yep.
I don't really blame her, to be honest. I just think she's not in the right job. It's not helped by the appalling dialogue she's given.
Mm.
Dreadful almost throughout, but it certainly gets worse as time goes on. As you say, there's nothing rounded about it. There's nothing to her, is there?
No.
I mean, she just becomes a screaming cipher, and it happens a lot in the past, but somehow she's more offensive. There's just nothing to her. But
I think McCoy, other than his first scenes, terrible. And episode one is awful. And I agree with you when we talked about it earlier. I can't think of a worse episode of Doctor Who at all. It's just cringeworthy. I think it does pick up in the other parts, you know, when you get second, third, fourth part. And McCoy improves immensely, and I think by the end of it, you're starting to see the character that's to come. So I think he comes out of it okay in the end. I think the Rani's pretty good in it. I thought her playing Mel, I thought she did quite a good job of it. I agree with you, I don't like it as a plot device. It's quite embarrassing, but I think, you know, I thought she got Mel to be honest.
McCoy got good quicker than I remembered. I thought it took a lot longer for him to put in a decent performance, but it really, by episode two, he's getting towards what he becomes later on, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he's definitely better. I prefer him to Colin Baker, you know, by part two of this. So, you know, by that stage, I'm happy, sort of thing. He's not good at anger, as we've discussed elsewhere, but I think everything else is good. He's got a nice comic touch, although it's overused in this story. I think they get the balance right later on.
Yeah. Funnily enough, in this one, he doesn't have to do a lot of anger, but he does a couple of bits, and he's actually quite good at it.
apart from the opening scene where he sees Irani and starts complaining about her ethics.
Yeah, but that's just an awful scene, full stop. I don't, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. Do we know whether that's the first thing he ever recorded as a doctor?
I don't know, actually. Didn't.
I don't know either.
Don't know.
But it has a feeling that it probably was. And it's dreadful. I like the sort of melancholy touches. And it's quite a warm portrayal. And actually, oddly, I found myself warming to the story the second time I watched it. And that's entirely down to Sylvester McCoy.
Mm.
I just thought, yeah, I actually like what he's done here. And as I said, he gets to a decent stage much quicker than I remembered. So that's all good, I think. You're talking about Kate O'Mara. Yeah, she's good enough, I think, as Irani. But I've never been particular fan of her character, but I think she does very well, really, with the terrible script she's given.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's a great character at all, but I think she does okay with it. And there's some quite good sort of looks from her, when disdainful looks, you know, when the Doctor's messing around and stuff. And,
I mean, she's a good actress, and she's done, you know, a ton of Shakespeare and all the rest of it. Mm. A lot of people only remember from Dynasty or Dynasty. If you're that way inclined. But, I mean, there's a lot more to her than that. I think she, amongst other sort of leading lights in this, probably wondered what they signed herself up for.
Mm.
But it's a quick word on plot in general. I found it kind of a mixture of incomprehensible and irrelevant, really. The threat is far too nebulous, isn't it? And it's revealed sort of seconds before it's averted, isn't it?
Yeah. They missed the trick, really. It needed, like we were saying, it needed to have been revealed before the end of part three, so that there was some tension there. But it's left right to the very end, and you're trying to figure out what it's all about, and then it's over.
Yeah, it's the dynamics of the script are all wrong, aren't they?
Mm.
It doesn't follow a logical path, and it's, as you say, it's over before it's begun almost.
Yeah, and the dialogue keeps repeating itself.
Mm.
Clockwise, it's not great at all.
It feels heavily padded, doesn't it? I don't know if it was if something's been pulled out of the script, or I can't imagine it would have been designed as a shorter story, because that didn't really happen at this stage, did it?
Well, we know it was put together
quickly
off the hoof, so they probably had some basic idea, and then they kind of tried to pad it out. Yeah. So I actually agree with you. The second time I watched it for this, I actually started to quite like it in places, and I still think part one's awful. And I can't stand Blow Man from there, no matter what you say. but, yeah, it did start to kind of grow on me a bit. But, yeah, it's a pretty terrible script and plot. What about the other characters? What do you think of them?
Okay, not a huge cast in this one, is there? Mark Greenstreet, I thought, was okay as Icona.
Mm.
He comes across more of a sort of a sulky teenager than any sort of rebel capable of stirring up any kind of revolution, doesn't he?
Mm.
He has some awful lines to deliver as well, doesn't he? I think he does his best with them, but he's not well served, I don't think. Donald Pickering as Baius and Wanda Ventham as Faroon were good, I thought. As I say, they must have wondered what the hell they signed up for.
Yeah. I thought they were okay, but they didn't really have a great deal to do. The way their characters were written didn't really give them much scope to do much with them, really.
No, well, Baius is always saying, I'm doing this for my people, and Faroon is always sort of mourning over somebody dying, really, isn't she? And that's it. I mean, they're underused for, you know, a pair of decent actors. And it's interesting from a Doctor Who point of view that they both appeared in the same story, the Faceless Ones, and they both appeared in this one.
Yeah.
But that's it, really. As you've said, Karen Clegg was dreadful as Zahn. And that only really leaves Richard Gauntlet as Urak, who was a monster by numbers, really, wasn't he? Quite cliched.
Yeah, he was. I mean, you know, he's quite kind of slimy, groveling to the Rani all the time.
Yeah.
Well, there's only one other speaking character, isn't there? That's Icona's brother.
Mm.
He was at about one scene. So, yeah, small cast. Well, a large cast, but a small speaking cast.
Yes.
There were quite a lot of tetraps and quite a lot of locutions, actually.
Yeah.
Most of them didn't say anything.
Well, yeah, let's talk about costumes then, if you're talking about tetraps and locutions. I would say average to poor. The locutions are set at typical 80s alien, aren't they? Sort of day glow, wrapped in a sort of throw, aren't they, with a mane and some scales. It's not interesting, really. Mm. The Tet Traps, I like less than you do. I thought they were awful.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word like.
Detest less.
Yeah, that's probably nearer the mark. I thought there was a good attempt, but it just ends up looking just a bit too much like a rubber suit. That's the problem.
The Slovene are like the more modern equivalent of
Yeah.
Tets. They are nothing but a person in a suit and could not be seen as anything else. Yeah. They're utterly unconvincing.
It's true.
And to be honest, if a passing casual viewer tuned in and saw that, I don't think they'd be hanging around long.
It's strange that the J&T kind of era, they didn't do good monsters, did they?
No.
You know, think of what they did with the Silurians in War of the Deep and that magma thing in the Caves of Androzani. I can't think of a good one. There probably are some good ones, but I can't think of them off the top of my head.
I think you're forgetting the Ergon.
Well, that's the exception that proves the rule, Jim.
Or an example that proves the rule. Yeah. They don't. In fact, it got to a stage where you were terrified that they'd bring an old monster back because they'd just ruin it.
Yeah. Curse of Fenric, the creatures in that were quite good, I thought.
Yeah, the Emo Boys were pretty good.
Yeah, but generally, they just lost the knack of doing monsters that look real, really.
Yeah, well, the Destroyer was quite good, but again, it didn't look anyway real, did it?
No. But I think they tried to do too much, tried to have animatronic heads and all this kind of thing. It was like, well, I just concentrate on getting a simple, effective mask. I mean, look at Davros, that was done 15 years earlier.
Mm.
How could they have lost that knack?
Well, they're not using any of the actors' face, so that I think is the main problem. I mean, I think Richard Gauntlet's jaw moved Urak's jaw when he spoke, but the jaw was so unrealistic that it doesn't really matter. Davros is slightly different, but it's better when you see the actor's real eyes, isn't it? As we were talking about in The Time Warrior.
Yeah, of course.
It's a fantastic mask because you can see his mouth, you can see his eyes, but everything still looks alien around it.
Yeah.
And you get more expression that way, and it looks more realistic that way than having false eyes and a false mouth and all the rest of it. And I think when Friedlander went, I don't think we had a decent monster after that, to be honest. I can't think of one.
No, you struggle to, don't you? Special effects, though, that's probably the highlight, really, isn't it? Because pretty good stuff. You know, the exploding bubbles, really good. I was amazed by that the first time I saw it. I mean, you look at it now, and it does look a little bit kind of dated, but it's still pretty effective.
Still pretty good, yeah. Decent model work, as we said, when they finally launched the rocket.
Yeah.
To be honest, nothing else is particularly good after that. There was both guns, the net gun and the gun that fired out the glitter, both pretty crappy.
Mm.
And the killer insects couldn't have been worse, could they?
Well, that is pathetic, really.
And even the brain isn't really that good. It's not particularly realistic. It just looks like...
At least it isn't in a jar with two goggly eyes and stalk.
I'd have that any time. This looks like a novelty tent or a bouncy castle for kids.
A bouncy brain.
Yes. Come on, children. Jump into the bouncy brain. As you said, the initial pre-title sequence with the TARDIS being zapped is awful.
Mm.
And the Rani's TARDIS, why it has to be CSO, I don't know, but that's an effect that fails drastically.
Yeah. You kind of get the feeling they used all their money on the bubble effects, and then we've got some sets we haven't built yet. What are we going to do?
To be honest, I thought the quarry location was excellent. I particularly like the sort of flooded bit, where the Mel's bubble trap lands. I really liked that bit. I thought it looked good.
I hated that bit because it meant that she survived.
Yeah, that was a definite downside to that scene. The sort of standing sets are good enough. The Rani's lab was okay, and the rest of the Citadel was all right, I think. And the Leisure Centre, I thought, looked pretty good.
Yeah, they're okay. Yeah, it's all very 80s.
Desperately 80s, but then everything's of its time, isn't it? But,
yeah.
I thought all that was good enough. What do you think of the direction?
Well, like I said, there's some quite nice little touches in it, when they cut away from, somebody holding a gun, then you get the McCoy soldering something, so it appears that for a second you get the feeling that the gun's been fired, that kind of thing.
I must admit, in either of those situations, it didn't hit me like that, but now you say it, I could see probably was what they're aiming for, yeah.
Other than that, I thought it was okay. I mean, nothing fantastic. Not anything that stood out as being poor, I don't think.
Nothing really sprung to mind, to be honest. hiding the full appearance of the tet traps, you know, delaying that full reveal was done okay, I suppose, but as I said, it's probably done for a different reason from usual. Andrew Morgan then went on to do Remembrance of the Daleks, didn't he? And I think he shines in that one. This is just workmanlike, really. It's not just about waving the camera, is it? It doesn't get a decent performance out of many people in this.
Well, he gets okay performances, as we said, from some, and the dire ones from others.
You can only work with what you're given, can't you?
Yeah.
I don't know if he had anything to do with the casting.
No, I don't know. It's normally JNT who gets the cut.
At this stage in the show, he seems to cast him. I mean, in previous eras, you often got directors using the same people again and again, didn't you?
Mm.
But this was Andrew Morgan's first Doctor Who. Perhaps he knew Donald Pickering and Wanda Bentham and maybe brought them in, which case that was good. But I don't know who came up with Karen Clegg.
She was only for a few minutes anyway, wasn't she?
Yes, she was, but enough to leave an impression. So, yeah, direction-wise, yeah, decidedly average, I think, but a couple of nice touches, maybe.
Mm. One of the other effects that we didn't mention then was the point of view of the tet traps.
Oh, yeah.
You said during the podcast was pretty good. Yeah, I think that was.
That was good, yeah. You got the definite feeling there was four eyes at work.
Mm.
So, incidental music? McCulloch? It's the beginning of an era, isn't it?
It is. It's quite intrusive, isn't it?
Yeah, and horribly dated. All those sort of synth orchestra stabs. Quite tiresome after a while.
Yeah, and it starts the trend of having to have something all the time. There's never a quiet moment.
Mm.
You know, some people have aimed that criticism at Murray Gold, although I think he's got better in the Moffat era than he was with Russell Davies.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But yeah, I just think there's too much going on and he's just trying too hard with it, really.
Mm.
And at times it does jar. A lot of the time it does jar, I think.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear a sort of clean version of this without any of that. I mean, I suppose you'd lose a modicum of drama. Not that there's a lot going on here anyway, but yeah, I mean, certainly I don't find it very helpful.
No, it's yet another disappointing aspect to the story. Should we do the ratings?
Yeah, okay. Shall I go first?
Fire away.
5 out of 10.
Blimey. A bit generous?
Yeah, I think it's lower than anything else I've given in all our podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might give Twin Dilemma 4 maybe, but I find it hard to give anything less than 5. But it got to a stage where watching this you wondered why they were bothering to carry the series on, so that's got to be pretty poor, hasn't it? Had all episodes been like episode 1, or had this rating been based on episode 1, then I would have given it a 1, I think.
Yeah, episode 1 is, you know, it does really drag it right down.
It gets a bit better, as we say, and drags it to a 4, but I'm going to give it a 5, I think.
Well, I'm going to go that one less. It only gets 4 for me, for all the reasons we've already said, but it's just not very good at all. Episode 1, dreadful. Mel is dreadful. Plot is all over the place. And yet there are aspects of it that I quite enjoyed. I think overall it doesn't warrant a high mark, but there is stuff in it that is worthy, I guess. Although it might be a stronger word than it deserves. But, you know, I think there is something in this if you persevere and look past the horribleness that is episode 1.
Okay, so a 4 and a 5. From Martin and me, respectively. Shall we have a look at some feedback?
Yeah, first up this time, we've got Mike Wenburn, who says, I looked for this on YouTube and gave it a quick watch. Thanks, guys. I'll never get that time back again.
Sorry, Mike. Martin, you should be saying sorry, Mike.
I made sure my wife and kids were out at the time and locked the door and drew the curtains, watching with the volume low. It reminded me of being a teenager again and watching Electric Blue 12. Fortunately, the BBC had tumbled my game and only the first 2 episodes were available to watch. I probably could have found the others elsewhere, but it didn't seem worth it. Now, the story, is it as bad as we all remember? Well, yes. The first 2 episodes were low on action, high on talking, and running around the grimmest-looking quarry in the show's history. I thought giving McCoy 2 chances to show his skills on the spoons was too many, not really adding much to the story.
With too many.
Yeah, the tet traps looked cheap and lumbering. The Rani got tied up just by McCoy wrapping his scarf around her. Bonnie Langford and McCoy can't act for Toffee. He looked like a big pantomime.
I was expecting Karen Ball or Peter Duncan to turn up in tights. Rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. The ball trap things were pretty good though. No more praise. Oh, and the music grated too. So Mike's not pulling any punches, is he? He added another bit, actually. He says, my mum always used to joke that she liked Rani Corbett, but not Rani Barker. Well, this was showing. I think it was clear by this time that not only the viewers, but also the production team weren't taking anything seriously about the show. It's also worth noting that all of the Doctor's old schoolmates, Time Meddler, Rani Master, turn out to be wrong-uns. Maybe he was at some Gallifreying borstal. None of my schoolmates had become master criminals, but then I did go to a grammar school.
So did I, Mike, and all my friends became criminals, including Martin. Okay, thanks for that, Mike. Good stuff, as always. Nick Davis, next up. I do remember the first watch of this and being excited about the new Doctor and the departure of Colin Baker. Well, I think I was probably a bit excited about the departure of Colin Baker. And being a wee lad, probably rather enjoyed it. As an adult, though, it lives up to its very poor reputation. It's the cheesy, hammed-up acting, probably stemming from the scripting, that gives it its cringe factor. The mullet-wearing Frankenstein-like tetraps are up there with the Candyman. The neon skies of whatever planet they're on, the 80s stings in the incidental music, and the cracking dialogue, leave the girl, it's the man I want, and the suspicious-looking Colin Baker impersonator at the start, and thus begins the TV era of Sylvester McCoy, which admittedly does get better. One more thing. Why do fans always hark back for the Rani? She's crap. And so are the two stories where they're in. Admittedly, I didn't get round to watching all the way through this time, but I'm sure that listening to your amusing commentary on the episode will be entertaining. Well, I hope so, Nick. I hope it wasn't too negative. But you can only comment on what you have in front of you, can't you, Martin?
This is true. Jeff Waddell has put a little bit on the Facebook page. He just says, I think this is the only Doctor Who available I haven't ever seen and can't bring myself to watch it. I like the latest Sylvester McCoy. In fact, he's in my top four or five Doctors. Brilliant podcast anyway. Short and sweet.
Yeah, shucks, Jeff. Thanks very much for that. Mike Doyle, back again. Just started watching Time in the Rani. Never saw this the first time round due to the crushingly unstable performances that made up the Colin Baker tenure. All I can say is, Jim, whatever you did to annoy Martin, please apologise and we can all move on from this unpleasantness. Well, that is exactly what I think, Mike, but I've apologised to Martin, but far too late. We had to go through the entire podcast.
Well, you know, suffice to say that it will never get as low as this again. Unless we do Time Lash. Actually, I think Time Lash is better, to be honest.
I think Time Lash is better.
It's a lot better, actually. Well, maybe we should do that next.
What? And lose all our listeners. Yes, rest assured, the next one will be better than this one. But thanks, everyone who... I'm not sure any of you actually finished watching it, but thanks to all of you who tried to watch it and gave us some feedback. Any other feedback you have on this one, we can include in the next podcast if you have any. The usual places, please, via email at crinoid@mail.com, at the blog site at crinoid.blog.co.uk, at our space on Facebook, or you can also follow or tweet us on Twitter. We are Crinoid. Now then, what next, young Marty?
Well, I think next up we were going to do The Seeds of Death. Is that correct?
Yeah. Patrick Troughton, Ice Warriors, Jamie, Zoe?
Zoe, yes.
So, yeah, Seeds of Death. Black and white Doctor Who. Classic in every sense of that word, I think. So, any thoughts on Seeds of Death? We would love to hear from you.
Excellent. So, that's it for this time?
Yes, it is. So, thanks for listening this time, and until the next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next time.
Dr. Phil again with another installment of Adventures in Time, Space, and Music. Here we'll be looking at the music of Kef McCulloch. In this episode, we will look at his work on Serial 7D, Story 144, Time in the Rani, which originally aired between the 7th and the 28th of September 1987 on BBC One.
Yeah!
In 1987, in addition to his incidental music, Kev McCulloch used the Sequential Circuits Prophet 5 synthesizer to create a new version of the Doctor Who theme, moved to A minor, replacing Dominic Glynn's E minor Trial of a Time Lord series theme, the first since the 1973 Delaware version to include the so-called middle eight in the opening credits. Having extensive background in popular music, working as both a sound engineer and as a musician, he was mostly known for engineering and producing singles for artists ranging from Acker Bilk, Johnny Logan, and Russ Abbott. If the Colin Baker era was the era of a Doctor in a Technicolor Dreamcoat, Kev McCulloch's era would be described using similar terms, mostly because of his colorful sound palette using orchestral hits and bold colors in his orchestrations. In addition to his score for Time and the Rani, Kev McCulloch composed scores for other McCoy stories, including Paradise Towers, Delta and the Bannermen, Remembrance of the Daleks, Silver Nemesis, Battlefield, as well as the VHS release of Shada, as well as the 3D 30th anniversary story Dimensions in Time. Surprisingly, there is a pre-title sequence filled with music filled with ambiguous augmented triads and asymmetrical syncopations. The opening is very striking and exciting indeed. I was surprised, studying the score for the first time since hearing it in the 1980s, how much Ron Grainer's theme is incorporated into this score. Interesting themes occur here. McCulloch's theme for the Locutians is otherworldly and seems to be one of the most interesting and popular music-inspired cues, filled with syncopations and colorful harmonies. Action music is rather anarchic sometimes, accompanying the well-realized Tetraps, the Ronnie's minions, filled with 1980s orchestral hits, which were very popular at the time, taking center stage whenever it's present. I do think when he attempts to convey atmosphere through slower material, it's rather effective, and the music accompanying The Strange Matter is quite dramatic, probably the most memorable musical material to the viewer. While fandom is not often forgiving to Kev McCulloch, his music is dramatic nonetheless, an interesting element of late 1980s Doctor Who to be sure. Hopefully you'll find this brief look into Kev's music worthy to give it a second chance and maybe see it in the wider context of the varied and interesting scores of the McCoy era.